Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from this.
All right. Hey, good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is a Wednesday morning. Yes, that means Wellcurd Wednesday, man. You hear Wellcurd Wednesday? At you request, every morning we have different themes for the music bumps coming back from commercial breaks in the news, and you guys pick them all. And today's theme is Wildcard Wednesday, which means any artist, any song, anything. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 on this Wildcard Wednesday. Here till 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and my main man, Steve Cochran, has your morning drive at 6 a.m. right here on WGN. Coming up on the show, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us. He usually joins us about once a month. He is an author, a journalist. He's written several books about the world of space and outer space. He is the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, and he joins us once a month to talk all things space and to answer any of your space-related questions or concerns or comments. Again, 312-981-7200. Always fun to talk with Rod. Rod, by the way, also has worked on a lot of science fiction movies in the past, and movies that contain a lot of special effects. So we thought we would actually go back and look at some of the movies, the blockbuster movies, like major blockbuster movies, not low-budget B-Z movies, but major blockbuster movies that have the worst special effects ever in them. And we will detail the scenes and tell you which movies, and you might want to look up some of this stuff online or remember seeing the movie, because some of the special effects are just laughably, hilariously awful. And these are like big budget blockbuster movies. So we'll get into that. Big Brother debuted last night. And if you're a regular listener, you know that I love Big Brother. I watch it every summer. It's only on two times this week because they're doing the big two-night premiere. And so it was on last night, it's on again tonight, and then it doesn't come back on again until Sunday. And then it's Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday for three nights a week. And so we're going to do some Big Brother talk about the current cast of season 21. And there's only one person from Chicago. Well, one person is from Chicago, but originally from Chicago, but doesn't live in Chicago anymore. There is another person who's from Chicago and lives here, and so I always like to talk about the contestants on the house guests on Big Brother who are from Chicago. So we'll get to that. But I have already formed a few, you know, opinions based only on the first hour of the show, and those obviously will change because you'll get to know the people or what they let you know as the show goes along. And then also we are going to rank the past winners of Big Brother. So if you're a Big Brother fan, we'd love to hear from you. And we'll do that later on. We also have Know Your Onion is going to happen this morning. Make sure you prepare for that. If you know your onion, you can win some prizes. And that's the deal is, Tom is your host. He will read to you news headlines. And you have to decide whether it's a real news headline or a fake satirical news headline from the satirical newspaper, The Onion. So your answer will be, he'll read the news headline to you, and you have to either go real or onion. And if you get the majority of the headlines correct, whether they're real or whether they are onion headlines, you win a prize. But everybody's going to be a winner, and we do that after 4:30. We do that every Wednesday morning after 4:30. And we also have some unusual college majors that we'll talk about. So that's what's coming up on the show. We would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and you can stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. So there you go. That's what's happening on the show. Let's say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick.
Hey, I finally have someone who's working with me on this show. who does not roll their eyes and laugh at me when I talk about how much I love Big Brother.
Big Brother is my favorite summer show.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous in all the best ways. Yeah. It's a thrill to watch.
Yeah. I love it. And I love Celebrity Big Brother. I was very upset and lost a lot of interest when Tom Green got voted out. Because Tom Green was clearly the best in the Celebrity Big Brother from last season.
Absolutely.
And when he got booted, I was like, eh. But it was still fun to watch.
Yeah, you got to see it through to the end.
Yeah, exactly. But I've already... Now, you didn't see the whole episode from last night.
No, I caught about midway because I totally blanked on it being on.
Yeah.
I was making dinner, and then all of a sudden I realized, oh, I think Big Brother's on tonight.
Yeah.
So I ran over and turned on the TV.
On again tonight at 7, so don't forget.
Yes.
But yeah, well, I want to discuss that. And if you guys watched it last night, we would love to hear from you if you're Big Brother fans out there. You know who's a huge Big Brother fan?
Who?
Our very own Wendy Snyder.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We got into a Facebook. We were Facebooking each other through the show last night. And she says she can't talk to anybody about it because Bill rolls his eyes whenever she mentions it. But she loves it. And we both unapologetically love Big Brother.
So Bill gets to talk about, you know, TV shows
Huckleberry
from the 40s.
Hound.
Yeah, exactly. And the Little Rascals all day. The mere mention of Big Brother. Ugh.
Yeah. So, I was like, yeah, I finally have someone, you know, because Dan never watched Big Brother. Esmeralda thinks I'm an idiot because I watch Big Brother. Vic doesn't watch Big Brother. So I was all alone.
I totally would have pegged him as a Big Brother guy.
Yeah,
he looks
like
the kind of guy hanging out on the base watching Big Brother.
I don't even know what that is, actually.
It's a reality show. It's a reality show on CBS. By the way, that's Vic Vaughn in the newsroom. He's covering all the news for you till 5. Well, no, actually, later than that, but till 5 on my show.
Yeah, I saw your conversation with Wendy as well.
Yeah, it's an admittedly ridiculous reality show, as most of them are, where they take a bunch of strangers and they stick them in a house, cut them off from society for 3 months. And they have to do many, many challenges, and America votes on who they like, and then it finally comes down to the last two people, and then someone wins $500,000 as being the winner of Big Brother. So basically, these are people living in a house 24/7, and the cameras are on 24/7, like right now.
Yeah.
At this moment, you could go to CBS Access and watch.
Can I do that?
Wow. Yeah, watch them. But you have to subscribe.
Oh
well, luckily I have a subscription. But so maybe I'll have
a password, Tom.
but no, it's 24/7, and they're cut off from everything. They've got no social media. They don't see their family or friends or anything like that. And they do these insane challenges. It is ridiculous, but I love it. I've watched it since the beginning, and I love it. And it's another thing. You know who else I bond with big time on this, Tom? My mother.
She's a Big Brother person?
Oh, man. Huge. Like,
Miss,
you know, like,
Mrs.
When,
DiGilio.
When episodes end, I'll call and go, did you see that? Yeah. So, anyway. But, yeah, that's it. Vic, I fully admit that it's ridiculous, but I love it. And now, you know, I've got a goofball on my show who also likes it. So we can actually discuss it a little bit.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So at least an hour of the show,
at least
three times a week.
I do a 4-hour show, 3.5 hours of which will be Big Brother talk. I just figured I would tell everybody that now. So, but Vic's in the newsroom. Vic, how you doing, man?
Doing just great.
Yeah? All right. Disappointing Cub game. I didn't turn it on until 8 o'clock because I was watching Big Brother.
Man, you must really love it.
No, I like to watch it as it's happening. You know, because, you know, like when you're watching a reality show, inevitably people are going to go up online and they're going to maybe do some spoilers, although it was only one episode. So it's not nobody got evicted yet, obviously. But something major happened on the show. They went into a different direction. This year's theme, instead of like it being like a regular Big Brother house, it's like they're indoor camping. It's the Big Brother summer camp. And I guess a lot of Big Brother hardcore fans out there, I was scrolling around online, do not like the house.
They're not vibing with it?
No. And the overwhelming comments were like, what is this? You know, the house is supposed to be like cool and, you know, luxurious, but they got fake trees in the house and tents and stuff like that. The initial response from the super fans is not positive.
I think it's a bold new direction that this show needs.
So anyway, yeah. Well, I mean, that it's a show that I believe started. I'm trying to think of where what country it started in.
I think it started in the UK.
Was it the? I thought it was someplace else, and then the UK. But yeah, but I know that the UK had it before we did. We'll do a little Big Brother talk a little bit later on. And if you are a fan of the show, we'd love to hear from you. That'll be later in the show. And we are going to go through Big Brother winners of the past and rank them. So that's all coming up on the show. So, all right. Listen, why don't we take a break? And again, you want to get in here. It's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We are about to welcome our good friend Rod Pyle. He is an author of several books, a journalist, a speaker, and an absolute expert on outer space and space-related issues. And if you have any questions about that in that comment or that subject, we would love to hear from you. Again, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Talk and text. When we come back, Rod Pyle is going to join us and talk everything space right here on WGN.
In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the bill you took today.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Wildcard Wednesday. Get your requests in. We'll play them later. It's Wildcard Wednesday. You mean Wildcard Wednesday? That's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. Get them in now. 312-981-7200. And that number is also the one to call or to text with any and all space out, outer space and space related questions. 312-981-7200 right now, because our good pal Rod Pyle is about to join us. He is an author. He's a journalist. He is a speaker. He is the editor in chief of the Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, and he joins us about once a month to talk about space. So let's see. Let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back. How are you, man?
Hello, Nick. I'm good. How are you?
Not bad. Good to hear from you as always. You've been busy. I was looking at some
Likewise.
Of the. I've been looking at some of the stuff that you've been doing.
Yeah, it's a busy season, and I'm enjoying the thrill of actually having a tiny bit of minor celebrity during the whole Apollo frenzy, and then I suspect in September it'll all fall off the cliff relative obscurity, except that I'll still be on your show,
of
which makes me as famous as I'm ever likely to get.
Oh,
so I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, Rod, tell everybody about yourself. We always do when we start off with your segments.
Yeah, so I was born about a year and a half before NASA, so I got to grow up with the space race and came acutely aware of it during the Apollo program. I was just an absolutely rabid fanatic and stayed at home during all the moonwalks with as many TVs as I could drag into the living room to have my own little mission control and my PJs.
Uh-huh.
And then really wanted to be a scientist, but higher calculus didn't agree with that assessment in me. So ended up learning a fair amount about it and then going into communications and media instead. Spent a bunch of years in documentaries and working on visual effects in Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica and some other stuff. And then started writing books in 2005, and I've been doing that in the magazine ever since, and I love it.
That's great, man. And you join us once a month, which is always a thrill and a pleasure.
Yeah.
Because that you worked on special effects and stuff like that, we are going to talk. One of the topics we're going to do after we let you go is we're going to talk about blockbuster movies that have some of the worst special effects of all time.
See, I got to go back to Green Slime again. We talked about this last time, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember that film?
Green
Probably
Slime.
Probably before your time.
Yeah, no.
Green Slime.
Yeah.
It was a hideous Japanese film that was dubbed over into English with two or three, you know, European actors in it, and monsters that were basically made out of large green garbage bags with automobile flares, and they had their tentacles. It did have Luciano Paluzzi in it, which was a reason to see it, but other than that, it was just the most miserable, wretched thing. I mean, even as a little kid, I remember watching this in theater thinking, this has got to be the worst movie in all creation. That's pretty close. However, you watch reality TV.
I do.
I was shocked to hear
while I
was eavesdropping before I came on.
Not
Big Brother.
Not all reality TV. I mean, Big Brother,
yeah.
I mean, I'm, but like I'm a ridiculous fan of Top Chef. That's probably my favorite reality TV show.
Yeah, actually the cooking shows are cool. I have to admit, I feel a little wimpy when I'm watching them, but they're really fun to watch.
I haven't seen
Big Brother for years.
And I have to say that Big Brother is an exception to what I usually watch, because I don't watch The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, or any of that stuff. And I can't even stomach that stuff. But for some reason, I don't even watch Survivor, which is like the granddaddy of them all. But for some reason, I have no idea why, but Big Brother compels me, and it's one of those shows that as I'm watching it, I can feel my brain cells disappearing, but I still enjoy watching it. So
is your deal with your mom that she'll let you stay living at home if you're watching Big Brother with her? Is that how it works?
No, I'm not living at home.
Sorry, I misunderstood.
No. I call her afterwards.
I know. I'm just enjoying that moment. But I, honestly, when I got out of reality TV for the final time was about the time Honey Boo Boo came out.
Oh.
And I think the last producing job I was offered was for American Jail or Vegas Jail or something. And it was, I think, 7 days on and two off, 12 hours a day, you know, watching guards be polite to prisoners until the camera stopped and then kicking their heads in. I thought, This isn't even entertainment. This is a crime of television.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway,
yeah.
Well, no, going off the rails here.
No, actually, well, hold on a second, Rob. What reality shows did you work on?
Well, I worked for History Channel for a long time. So it was A&E when we called it the Evolve and Eva Channel, because we did mostly War in Space and whatever was free footage. And the last thing I did was a show called Feng Shui Living. We did home invasion feng shui makeovers. But it was actually, it sounds goofy, but it was kind of cool because it's really environmental psychology with some hocus pocus added, right?
Yeah.
So you go into some rich person's home down in San Diego. You couldn't do it in L.A. because everybody had their hand out for 10 grand, and it was a low-budget show because they all are.
Right.
We go into these fabulous homes, 10,000 square feet, and the couch is in the wrong position, and the stairs are in such a way that your good vibes are going into the toilet and being flushed away, and you will never get rich again and all that.
Right,
of course, it's a 10,000 square foot home, right? So they already made it. So we'd move furniture around and do some painting and change stuff and go back a week later, and everybody said they felt better, and none of their children had died or anything, so I guess the feng shui worked. But it was a very cool show to do.
Yeah.
And the people were nice, so yeah.
I'm not delusional. I know that the word reality in reality show isn't reality. I'm aware.
Well, there's a reason they have story editors on the set.
Oh yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
What is a story editor? They're a fiction writer.
Right.
Okay, I get that.
But yeah. I will say this: I am guilty of watching the really crappy stuff that VH1 used to show, like your Mob Wives and your Dr. Drew Celebrity Rehab. I would watch all of that crap, and I would watch it and go, this is crap.
Did you ever watch Cheaters with Joey Greco?
Are you kidding me? Yeah.
So do you remember the episode where he gets stabbed?
Yes, I do. He's on a boat.
He's such a jerk.
Yeah, he got stabbed. He was on a boat. He gets stabbed. Now, it's sad. It's a sad story. But the last host of that show, because they went through Joey Greco, Tony Grand. These guys had the best names ever. Because the first guy who hosted Cheaters was a guy named Tony Grand. He was the first guy. Then
porn stars.
Exactly. And then Joey Greco, and he's the guy who got stabbed. And the last host of it, who unfortunately just passed away, it was a suicide. Was Clark?
Oh.
His name was Clark Gable, and he was in fact the grandson of Clark Gable.
You are kidding?
No.
That is amazing.
No, I'm not kidding.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
No, I didn't see those guys. I just saw Joey Greco.
Yeah.
But I guess my only guilty pleasure was a pint of chocolate chip peanut butter ice cream and Cheaters. And what was the other one I used to watch occasionally? Cops.
Cops, of course.
Because you got to watch Cops.
Yeah, you have to watch Cops. But my favorite.
You want to see. You want to feel smart, right?
My favorite reality. Well, that's why people watch this stuff. They look at it and they go, my life's not that bad. When you're watching,
exactly.
I'm
smarter than that guy.
Yeah, like you watch Hoarders and you go, my apartment's not that dirty. But my favorite reality show of all time, like legitimately, was only it was a one season show. It was on VH1 and it was called Bands on the Run. And it was about four bands who got a van, each got a van. They got on the road. They were given a little bit of money at each city They drive through the city, and then they try to sell tickets for their gigs and sell merch, and whoever, you know, sells the most tickets and merch wins or has to go into a battle of the bands. And I loved that show. It was just, it was like watching bands on the road trying to get popular, and I loved that show. And
that is cool.
Yeah, it was a great show. And the winning band was a band called Flicker Stick. I'll never forget it. And they never, I'll tell you something, Rod, they never won any of the cities, because they would go to the city, and instead of like trying to drum up sales and get people to come to the gig and to sell t-shirts and other merch, they would just get drunk and fight. And then, you know, so they wouldn't win, but they won every battle of the bands. So that's why they won.
But with a name like Flicker Stick, they're just inviting to be the kid on the playground that gets beat up every day, you know?
Yeah, this was, I can tell you the four
My
bands.
My name is Jonathan Flicker Stick, really.
These were the four bands, and then we gotta take a break for the news. But we're talking a lot about space here, Rod. This is amazing.
You bet, man.
These are the four bands that were on the one season of Bands on the Run. It was Flicker Stick who won, Soul Cracker. Harlow, who was an all-chick metal band, and
now you're talking.
And the Josh Dotis band, who was like kind of like the Dave Matthews kind of band on the show. It was. I watched it every week. My ex-girlfriend and I were obsessed with that show. So
wow,
yeah.
Well, I hope that isn't why she's an ex-girlfriend.
No,
that,
it's not.
That makes me sad.
No,
okay.
Now you know why she's an ex-girlfriend. She didn't like Flicker Stick. That's what it is. That's what broke it.
Well, see, and now if you're going to talk dirty to me, we got to take a break here.
All right, Rod, hang on, okay, man.
Okay,
Rod Pyle is with us. We will get to the world of space, but I just have fun talking with Rod about anything. So, but if you guys have any comments or questions about space outer space or anything of that, or any of those things, we will get to those questions right after we take a break for the news. It's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive. It's Wednesday. That means Wildcard Wednesday. You hear me, Wildcard Wednesday? Get your requests in now. Any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. That is also the number to call or text to, 312-981-7200, with any and all outer space-related questions. Because Rod Pyle is with us. He is an author, a speaker, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and joins us about once a month to talk all things outer space and space-related. And let's get Rod back on. Rod, welcome back.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We got someone on the line who has a question.
Okay.
We get back to some of these news stories, but here's Donald. Go ahead, Donald.
Okay. Hi, Donald.
Hi, yeah. It's basically how much influence the current president will have on space program. Is there going to be a space force, and we're going to see militarism more in space? And also, he says, well, forget about the moon. Let's go to Mars, you know, concentrate on that. So these are like pronouncements from the White House. I was wondering, how much weight does it carry? And you know, are they still going to go on their own agenda?
No, so there is no agenda, no their own agenda. I mean, NASA works for the president, basically. So in between them is the National Space Council. So you have the executive office, who's got to sell Congress on programs to fund NASA. NASA does what they're told. But now we have this new group. Actually, it's a revived group. They've been in business twice before. It works between the executive branch and NASA, called the National Space Council. That's made up of the members of various cabinets in the government and industry and some private citizens. And the idea is that they work with the president to formulate strategic policy, and then that's handed off to NASA to execute. So Trump has a lot of influence right now. I mean, he and Mike Pence are the reasons that the National Space Council was able to sort of dictate this pivot to back to the moon by 2024. However, as you've seen many times before, when his term is up, if he doesn't get a second term, we could see that program shift dramatically. So I guess the answer is presidents have a lot of influence while they're in office, and then suddenly not very much once they're out.
All right, Donald, thanks for the question. Let me ask you a question about the National Space Council. How does one get into the National Space Council? How does that work? What's the process?
It's like so many things in government. You have to already be important and noteworthy. So the people that are on there have been at this a long time. Scott Pace is the executive secretary, and he's been at various universities and think tanks for decades. And he was actually a member of the NSS at one time. But
wow.
So, you know, he's a big mucky muck. Vice President Pence chairs it. So he's obviously the vice president. And then you've got a bunch of people, like I said, at cabinet levels from various parts of the government. So they're all pretty heavy hitters. There's an advisory council that I remember when they said, hey, we have a citizens advisory council. I thought, well, I'll go over there and look just to see. Maybe that would be sort of a cool thing. Oh, it's got people like Buzz Aldrin on it, you know, sort of interested and Rod Pyle, who, you know, right. No matter how many books a year I write, I don't get to go on.
Right.
So it's, you know, they are doing a lot to formulate this new pivot. To answer Donald's other question, you know, Space Force, it's amazing how quiet it's gotten, isn't it? So
yeah.
There's all this talk about we're going to do this. My impression from talking to people I knew kind of on the inside was always, you know, we're not talking about fighter pilots and Viper fighters. We're talking mostly about unmanned and robotic stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's still the case, but it's been subsumed by the Air Force for now. Suppose it's going to be incubated in the Air Force and then spawned out on its own. I kind of wonder if some of the people in charge are saying, you know, let's keep it in the Air Force until Trump's term is up or terms are up, and then see what happens. But that's just supposition on my part. I don't really know.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for answering that question. Thank you for the call, Donald.
Yeah.
Steve says he texts in, and you can text as well at 312-981-7200. My question for Rod is, in watching all these specials on the Apollo missions, it got me to wondering what happens to the lunar landing modules when the Apollo spacecraft separates from them. Are they still orbiting the moon, or do they eventually crash and land on the surface? And by the way, Steve says, I had the great fortune of seeing Apollo 15 lift off in July of 71.
Oh, okay, I'm not going to answer his question because I resent him already. I wanted to see any Apollo launch, and I begged my dad to take me to 17, and he said, nah, we can't do that. I said, but it's the last one.
Yeah.
He said, nah. So I never saw that. Hopefully I'll see a Falcon Heavy one of these days. My recollection is that most of them are deorbited. Apollo 13 obviously came back to Earth, and that ascent module wasn't jettisoned until they were right about to re-enter because they were siphoning battery power off. But the other ones, I believe, were deorbited down to the moon to rejoin the landing stage, albeit by impact.
Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of SpaceX, which we always do every month,
yeah,
the Falcon Heavy had some. It had a lot of stuff that it brought up.
Don't get technical with me, yeah. Buster. Yeah, it had a lot of stuff. So it launched yesterday at 2:30 in the morning Eastern, which I think was a little after the original launch time, but I haven't checked. And this was the first reuse of previously flown Falcon Heavy side boosters. So,
and that's a big deal, right? That's a big deal, right?
Yeah. Yeah, each time he does this, you know, so we've gotten used to, okay, he's flying used Falcon 9s. We've seen that a bunch of times. How quickly would you get used to this incredibly difficult thing?
Right.
But he hadn't reflown components of the Heavy before, so this is reusing the side boosters, I assume, from two flights earlier, although I didn't check that either. But once again, they lost the center core. So the first Falcon Heavy launch, which was a test, admittedly, center core was slamming in the ocean, but their side boosters came back fine. Second one, the center core did come back and land on the barge, but apparently when it toppled over, because it hadn't been secured properly, which is supposed to be an automatic thing, it was damaged beyond repair. And this one, once again, missed the barge and went hurling into the ocean. But they knew it was going to be tricky anyway because, as you say, it was carrying a lot of stuff. It had a NASA payload, a few experiments, including this cool deep space atomic clock that they're flying. A Department of Defense payload, question mark there, not quite sure what that is.
Yeah.
Bunch of university CubeSats, Planetary Society, light sailed test object, the ashes of some well-known and not-so-well-known people that wanted to have their ashes flown in space, and some other stuff. So it was a complex mission because they had to do four burns on the upper stage to reach three different orbits because these things were deploying at different altitudes and inclinations, I guess. So that's, you know, it's a lot of flying around and up and down and sideways. And by hook or by crook, the center core, the main center part of the rocket came back and slammed into the ocean. So
yeah. But
he did catch one of the fairing halves this time.
Oh,
is that cool?
Yeah.
They had their little boat with the catcher's mitt out there
with the net
on the back.
Right.
And they actually maneuvered under it. I don't know about you, even though this thing's coming in on a parachute, they're pretty heavy. They're a big chunk of of metal and composite, and to be deliberately maneuvering your boat under this thing when it's coming down at a brisk run speed is probably kind of scary, but they did it.
That's pretty cool. You mentioned the remains, the cremated remains. It was 152 people that they brought out there.
Yeah, well, it's parts of 152 people, yeah. So you're not taking up the whole, you know. I mean, if you've ever seen a person cremated remains, it's about the size of a small coffee can.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then for Celestis, I think you're just taking up, you know, about as much as you'd probably fit in a Coke spoon or something.
Okay.
If that. But, you know, it's enough to make the point, and a bunch of people have done it. There's a guy who does a radio show that's all about space called The Space Show, and he actually set up the remains of one of his dogs. He cared about her so much.
So I think
it's a really, it's a cool thing, but it's not cheap.
Yeah. Explain what Light Sail 2 is.
Light Sail 2 is a second experiment. Planetary Society has long been interested in solar sails, and I worked with another group that was designing a solar sail about the same time they started. And these things go up, you know, compressed in a canister, and when they get to space, they unfurl this huge mylar sail. It can be anywhere from a number of meters to, in theory, kilometers wide.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit there in orbit, and then eventually, or you can propel them and deploy them out of orbit if you want, and eventually the pressure from the solar wind pushes the sail, and you can actually, because it's continuous acceleration, you can get really high speeds to the point that these things could fly out of the solar system, you know, and go well beyond. So it's a completely passive way of moving around in space that requires a little more than just some maneuvering fuel. They're really neat.
Okay.
The last one didn't work properly. We hope this one will. The Japanese tried with some mixed success, but I think this is the next big shot, yeah.
Okay. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
And when we come back, we got a lot more to talk about, but the first thing I want to talk about is that deep space atomic clock that you mentioned, because I read a little bit about it, and it sounds really cool.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Hang on, Rod. Rod Pyle is with us, and if you have any questions about space or outer space news stories or anything like that, you want some answers. Rod Pyle is here. He is our expert. You can check out pylebooks.com, and we have a link on our Facebook page as well. So facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, more with Rod Pyle after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m. It's Wild Card Wednesday. We'll get to that in a little bit. Get your requests in now. Yeah, man, Wild Card Wednesday. 312-981-7200. We'll play the requests a little bit later on. We're going to be talking about blockbuster movies that have some of the worst special effects that you can possibly imagine. We're also going to do some Big Brother talk. Big Brother debuted last night, and we're also going to talk about the past winners and rank them. And as well as a lot more, and some unusual college degrees that you can get, majors. So there you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right now, though, we want to get back to our conversation with Rod Pyle, author, journalist, space expert, and speaker. And we are talking about space stories in the news, and we want to hear from you. If you want to text or call us at 312-981-7200, here's Rod. Welcome back, Rod.
Hey.
All right, so
atomic clock.
Yes,
man.
Let's talk about that. That was sent up as well.
Yeah, so this is something they've been working on for quite a while. I think, God, I wrote about it in, I think, 2015, and at that point it had already been built and was under testing. So the idea is, you know, for spacecraft, everything from GPS to New Horizons out past Pluto depend on really accurate clocks to navigate and measure their position and so forth. So they have been using, till now, quartz clocks, which are fairly accurate but can drift over time. And depending on what speed the spacecraft's going and so forth, that drift can be pretty significant in terms of what it represents in navigational error.
Yeah.
So NASA wanted to fly an atomic clock, but they're big and heavy, and you know they got all this complicated equipment to do what they got to do. So they finally downsized this thing enough. What was the stat? This one uses mercury atoms, and we'll be off by less than a nanosecond after 4 days, and it would take 10 million years for the clock to be off by a whole second.
Oh, wow.
NASA says. So it's a lot more accurate time-wise than quartz crystal clocks, regular quartz crystal clocks. And one of the goals, which I hadn't really understood until I read that article that you sent, was because of having to constantly measure and reset, I guess, the timing on the spacecraft.
Yeah.
They have these two-way signals, so it's pinging being pinged by Earth and then sending a signal back down, then they send a correction. So besides measuring the speed and distance by measuring the delay of the radio signal, they're also resetting the clock's accuracy. And they're tired of doing that because it takes up a bunch of time on the tracking dish. So apparently with this new clock, assuming that it works as well in orbit as it has on Earth, they'll be able to kind of let it do its own thing for much longer periods of time. And, you know, it's really one of the big goals of 21st century spaceflight has been increasing autonomy. You want the rovers more autonomous on Mars. You want spacecraft out by Jupiter and Saturn and beyond to be more autonomous so you don't have these huge multi-hour round-trip radio conversations. And if something starts to happen, you want it to be able to react. So this is just another example of the additional autonomy in these things.
Wow. And how long is it going to be out there? Or is it?
I think they said it's a matter of months, so it's a pretty short mission. And it wasn't a very expensive mission either, as these things go, you know, because you can pay easily $800, $900 million for an ambitious, you know, Mars orbiter or something. So this was, I think, down below the Discovery class. It was probably 100-something. It's still a lot.
That's still a lot, man. Yeah.
Things go, it's not. Yeah, but, you know, that's by our standards as little people, right?
Yeah, very true. How about this? 773 area code says, I'm fascinated with black holes in space. Until recently, it was thought that anything that enters one is lost forever, but some studies have shown that this is not true. Can you expound on this? And also, Rod, we got to finally see a black hole a couple of months ago.
Yeah, we talked about that. That was really something. And it was, what did we figure out? It was like 3 years of measurements that they had done with radio science and then managed to layer it together and basically construct a visual image out of it. It was kind of fuzzy and weird looking, looked kind of like a big red fingernail, but they were saying that they thought they'd, in the next number of years, be able to increase the measurements, the density, that they'd be able to get a really crisp image of it, which is pretty cool. So my understanding of black holes has always been that from the perspective of the person in the spacecraft that's hurtling towards its fatal encounter, you would enter the black hole and be squished. But for the perspective of an external observer, you basically get stuck at the event horizon and just sit there because all the weird warping in time and space that happens, and time basically slows down to infinite slowness, and you're stuck there.
Yeah.
But, you know, that cosmology is not really my thing. And I remember reading all this in the 70s before they knew half as much as they know now. But I haven't really kept up with it, I'm sad to say. So that's kind of my half-brained answer on what he was asking.
All right, but we got to see one. That was the
well, question. And we both got to see the movie Black Hole, which really defined it for us. Because now we now know that a black hole, if you fly into it, looks like a tunnel made out of tin foils and has angels that look like moths at the far end of it, right?
Right, exactly. Speaking of blockbuster movies that have terrible special effects. I remember seeing Black Hole in the theater and just like shaking my head like, what am I watching? And I was like, I was like 15 when it came out, and I was just like, what am I doing in this theater? And then, but I'll tell you what, Disney hyped the hell out of that movie. They hyped the hell out of that movie.
Well, it was kind of, as I recall, wasn't that kind of they spent so much on it, it was kind of their make-or-break movie.
Yeah.
When they were still kind of a traditional studio in the old mold. I remember, I think I told you last time we were talking about it, I saw it in the U.S. and thought, this is horrible.
Yeah.
It was one of the worst sci-fi movies there. It had good, you know, it had Maximilian Schell, which was cool, and the robot was cool, and the rest of it just stank to high heaven. Yeah. And then, I don't know, 2 years later, I was traveling on this globe-trotting trip, and I was, I think, in Thailand.
Right.
And I was just desperate to see a movie in English, and you had to go in the theater, and then they had a little glass room in the balcony where it was in English so you wouldn't disturb the people hearing it in Thai.
Yeah.
And I thought, it can't be as bad as I remember it. And I'm so desperate for anything in English. This is Bangkok in 1980, you know, it was a very different city than now. And it was every bit as bad, and I went outside, and it was even bad in Thai. So it was just bad all the way around.
Yeah, no, I remember it was a terrible movie, but it was hyped. You know, I saw it like the opening weekend, and there was a theater. Yeah. There was a theater here in Chicago that was called the Will Rogers, and the Will Rogers was named obviously after Will Rogers. And this was the theater where almost exclusively for many years, all the Disney movies played there. That's all that was played there. This was a big auditorium. This was back when before multiplex. This was a regular movie theater. So it was one theater, one screen. And so all of the Disney movies would play there. And especially all of the terrible early 70s live action pieces of crap that they released. All the terrible ones with like Joe Flynn and Phil Silvers and, you know, I mean, just like these really terrible, the Apple Dumpling Gang and the North Avenue Irregulars, they all played there. And Black Hole played there. And I remember going to see it, and it was, there wasn't an empty seat in the house. The place was completely and absolutely packed. And, you know, like I said, I was a teenager. I was in high school, and I saw this movie, so I was already cynical. And I was like, this is terrible. And it didn't get good reviews. But the thing that I remember most about that movie, besides it being terrible and it being hyped, and it was playing, of course, at the Will Rogers, where we saw all the crappy Disney movies, it was a big deal because it was the first PG-rated movie that Disney ever released. All of their movies had been rated G up until that point, and everybody was like, ooh, edgy. I remember thinking, Disney's being edgy. This is the first PG movie they ever released. That's the one thing I remember about how, other than it being bad.
The Robot Max had blenders for hands, right? like, you know, make your guts into consomme. But I remember during that era, Disney was so tone-deaf as to what the rest of the planet wanted.
Oh,
you know, they knew what they wanted in their little cloistered studio up in Burbank. And I remember I worked there for a while, and it was, you know, they still had the bandstand in Main Street and people walking around whistling Skippity Doo-Dah and all that. And I thought, wow, you're as bad as those wackos that work at Disneyland who are smiling all the time, except you're not doing it because you have to. You're doing it because you really believe.
Yeah.
And so they made these movies that were completely out of sync with the rest of humanity.
Absolutely.
And you're thinking, you guys need to start doing some focus groups or polls or gang fights or something to figure out what people want to watch.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Rob, because I was the target audience. I was the target demo at that time.
Yeah.
Because when those, like, I mean, I still have a soft spot in my heart for, like, the Witch Mountain movies, Escape from Witch Mountain, because Kim Richards was in it, so, of course, I had a crush on her. But, like, but all of those terrible, like I said, North Avenue Irregulars, the Gus, the mule that could field goal kick, I mean, all of these, and they had just the same actors were in them, and they were just every live action movie in the 70s that came out from the
Dean Jones.
Oh, that darn cat.
Herbie 3. You know,
yeah.
It just got worse and worse.
Yeah,
in the 60s, you could kind of get away with that stuff. Yeah. And I have to admit, I was telling somebody today, I had the biggest crush on Mary Poppins as a kid.
Did you?
She was gorgeous. She could sing well.
Yeah.
Kind of sexy in that long dress. You know, that's when it started to get a little dark because I was hitting puberty. But
I was,
amazing.
I was a Haley Mills guy. I was a big time Haley Mills guy.
She was cute.
Yeah. My first three crushes, like celebrity crushes, were right around the same period. And it dates me completely because it's Haley Mills, Barbara Feldon, and Yvonne Craig. Those were
Barbara Feldon.
Oh, man. I loved her on Get Smart.
She'd rattle like a bag of bones. She's so skinny. Wow.
I
she's always whining, oh, Max. Wow.
All right.
But yeah, Haley Mills was, you know, you knew that it would be hand holding and that's it.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
She was just too sweet. Yeah.
Okay, Rod, hang on.
All right.
We're going to take a break, come back. We'll talk more space. We got a couple more texts here and a bunch of more shows. And by the way, Rod went to the White House since the last time we saw him. So he had dinner at the White House. We're going to talk about that and much more. And if you guys want to jump in with any of your space questions or thoughts, it's 312-981-7200. The news is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Wednesday morning, Wildcard Wednesday. You hear me, Wildcard Wednesday? Get your requests in. We'll play them later. That's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about blockbuster movies that have perhaps the worst special effects that you've ever seen in your life. That's coming up. We'll talk a little bit about Big Brother, which the new season debuted last night. We'll rank the past winners and talk about the current cast that was unveiled last night. And also another edition of Know Your Onion. And that's Tom will be your host, and he will read you a news headline. And you have to decide whether it is a real news headline or a headline from The Onion, which, of course, is a fake satirical newspaper, a comedy newspaper. And the headlines are not real. They are from The Onion. So, but it, the reason why this game works so well is because the real news is so weird now that it could be from The Onion. That's how strange it's gotten in the real world. So we'll play Know Your Onion. We'll do two separate contestants, and we'll do that at 4:30. So make sure you're tuned in for that, for Know Your Onion. But right now we are talking with Rod Pyle, our good buddy, good friend. He's an author of approximately 500 books. He is editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine for National Space Society. He's a speaker and an expert on space, and we have him on once a month. And Rod, welcome back, Rod.
Thanks. You demoted me from 10,000 to 500 books.
Oh, did I do that? Okay, I'm sorry. 10,500.
There you go. Oh, thank you. I'd actually be getting some royalties at that point.
Well, a couple of things you've done since the last time we talked. You just got back from the National Space Society's annual conference, and before the last time we talked to you, it was right before you went to that. So tell us about that and how that went.
So it was great. It was in D.C., just outside D.C., actually, in Pentagon City, which isn't as grim as it sounds, and kind of a cool Sheraton hotel that had a view of the mall and the White House and all that stuff. And I think we got about 1,200, 1,300 people this time. About 500 of them were students. So increasingly, we're getting kids there, a lot of them from overseas, a lot of kids from India, a lot from Eastern Europe. It's kind of these two big chunks, like Romania and India. And then a number of other Europeans, not nearly as many American kids as we'd like, because we want to, of course, bring in kids from, I say kids, young people from here, too, because, you know, we want to share the mission across all nationalities, which is, look, you guys, STEM is important. We need you in these fields. This is why it's cool. This is why there's things happening. And, you know, we had the head of NASA there talking. We had the head of one of their technology directorates. We had one of the early female shuttle astronauts there, Eileen Collins, who was wonderful. Apollo 15 astronaut, NASA flight director. So all these really cool people speaking and signing books afterwards and chatting with folks and then doing breakout sessions just for the students. So it's really become this kind of multi-platform sort of thing. I think there was 50 different talks in 3 or 4 days, something on that line. So there's a lot of, it's kind of like a theme park. You can kind of pick your ride and head that direction.
Sure.
So it's really rich that way. So next time we're in Chicago, you got to come.
Oh, okay. Is that the next time is it going to be next summer?
No, unfortunately, next year it's going to be in Dallas, but you're welcome to come to that one, too. I'm not sure when we're coming to Chicago. I'll have to check. But probably in the next 5 years, so you and I will still be young enough to drink together.
How long has that? How long has the National Space Society Conference, how long has that been going on?
I think the organization, it was two different organizations, both started about 74, 75, they emerged in the 80s, and I think the ISDC conference has been going since 84, maybe before that. So it's been a long time. It's kind of gotten bigger and smaller over the years, but in the last handful of years, there's been some new blood injected in the running of it, and it's just been really spectacular. So we're looking forward to Dallas next year because we're going to have the only downside to this was the hotel was kind of small, so Dallas is going to be huge.
Yeah.
So that'll be a good one.
That'll be good. And has it ever been in Chicago before?
It was in Chicago in 88, I think, and then again since then, but I didn't go to the second one. I just went to the 88 one, which was the year, it's either 88 or 87. That was the year I was standing in the bar. Jonathan Frakes had been a speaker there at the conference. He had already left. He plays number one on Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah.
I was standing in the bar, you know, with this gut that I've got, but I had a beard, and there is a very vague resemblance if you're half blind and completely drunk or stoned. So this completely drunk or stoned guy comes up, and I'm thinking of the bar. He says, "Hey, how's it going?" "It's fine." So how is it? I guess, yeah, fine. What's up with the captain, man? Hey, an episode. And I realized this guy was so out of it. He's wearing these Coke bottle glasses. He thinks I'm Jonathan Frakes. So I started talking him up. I'm like, "Oh, you know, Patrick Stewart, greatest guy. I mean, totally gay, but he's the greatest guy." And really just having it. And he was really horrified at the things I was saying. I'm not sure he ever recovered. But
wow, that's pretty funny.
Pushing one fan off the boat, you know.
That's pretty funny, man. But now, where were you? Where was this held? Do you remember?
Roseland?
Rosemont.
Rosemont.
Yeah.
It was out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of, that's Roseland. Where I host, I'm one of the hosts at a horror film convention every year, and of course it's in Rosemont because that's where you know, there's like 800 hotels and it's right by the airport.
So, right. Yeah. Okay. So that's like Convention Central,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Got it. Okay. Right. Well, that makes sense then. Yeah.
All right. So you did a lot. How many of the talks were you a part of?
I did 7 presentations in 4 days, which was about 4 too many.
Oh, yeah.
So I was between that and the meetings and various press events and then trying to cover some of this stuff, I was totaled by the end of it. But that's part of the fun of it, right? You get so sort of in this surreal state that you just begin experiencing it like a direct injection of heroin or something. And by the time you're done, you don't remember anything. You just remember you had a good time.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I know, it's a 3-day. This horror convention is a 3-day convention, and I do a bunch of Q&As and I barely sleep. By the Sunday evening when I get home after that weekend, I take the week off from work.
Wow.
Yeah, I do.
So I went to, a couple months ago, I went to NorwestCon, which is up in Seattle.
Yeah.
I think it's horror, fantasy, science fiction, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're surrounded by Klingons and elves and orcs and snorks and whatever else.
Oh, yeah.
And I was talking to this guy who had been going since the beginning in the late 70s, early 80s, and he said, you know what I just noticed this year? And I said, what? Because I hadn't been to one of these things since probably 1993.
Yeah.
And he said, the same people are here that were here in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
They're just all older and grayer.
Yeah.
And it hadn't occurred to me, but he was right. You know, this whole cadre of people kind of grew up together, and they're still digging the same stuff and going to these things. And there were young people there, but not many.
Yeah.
And I wonder why you think that might be, because I don't know that crowd. Why is it kind of graying out?
I'll tell you what, you know, ours is exclusively horror. There's not really a lot of fantasy stuff that we do. It's mostly just horror. Hmm. And there are a lot of kids who show up at our convention. But like you said, I've been, you know, this convention has been around since 2002, and I've been one of the hosts since the very first one. So I've been doing it for a long time. And yes, I see the same people every year, and some of the same vendors every year selling their stuff, you know. And but we do get a pretty good amount of younger people, and maybe it has to do with the horror genre is more appealing to younger people. I don't know.
Hmm.
Yeah. But it's fun,
though. That scares me a little bit.
That scares you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, whatever happened to those sweet little Star Wars stories instead of Saw 15?
I always love, because whenever there are little kids who, like, their parents have dressed them up, in costume, and they probably don't even know what they're dressed up as.
Right.
My favorites are the little girls who come dressed up like the girl from The Ring. And then they're in character. Like, they'll crawl across the floor like the girl climbing out of the TV. And it's fantastic to watch these little kids. There was a little kid who a couple of years ago was in, because there's a costume contest that they have every year at this convention. One part is for kids and one part is for adults. So you get to see all kinds of insane costumes. And one kid was dressed up, and I'm sure he had no idea because he was probably about 5. His dad dressed him up as Roddy Piper from They Live. And it was fantastic.
I love that movie.
Yeah, me too.
It was stupid, but it was fun.
Oh, I love that movie. And the kid was wearing a mullet. He had the costume on with the flannel. And he had a big bucket of double bubble bubble gum, because there's that famous line in the movie where Roddy Piper says, "I have come here to chew bubble gum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubble gum."
Right.
So he put the kid had this giant bucket of bubble gum, and I fell in love with this kid. And then the following year, last year, do you remember the movie with Rosie Grier and Ray Milland called The Thing with Two Heads?
Yes.
Okay, he came as that. He had Rosie Grier attached to his head. It was the fun. He had like a mannequin head with Rosie Grier's face on it, and I'm telling you, I almost fell off my chair laughing. So
that is hilarious.
Yeah, it's great.
So how many little kids come as Chucky? I mean, that's
got
to be.
No, we got kids as Chucky. We get, there's a, you know what, one of the overwhelming ones that we get every year, we get a lot of, you know, not just as little kids, but adults. There's a lot of Freddy Kruegers. I mean, there's an insane amount of Freddy Kruegers and an insane amount of Michael Myers, because all you got to do is get a white mask and a jumpsuit, or like, an auto mechanic suit, and have a butcher knife in your hand, and you got a costume. So, but
okay,
yeah.
So I have disturbing horror confession to make.
Okay.
About a year ago, I was buying some DVDs on closeout in this online thing, and I saw Trilogy of Terror.
Oh, yeah, man.
Which was the TV movie, complete with the burned-in yellow bad optical titles beginning with Karen Black.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In one of the three. The one everybody remembers is the little Zulu War Doll.
No, actually, Rod, she's in all three. She's the female.
Oh, is she?
Yeah,
okay.
She's the female lead in all three of them. By the way, I want to just tell you this, Rod. My producer Tom, who is a horror fanatic as well, had never seen Trilogy of Terror. He'd never seen Trilogy of Terror until just recently.
And what did he think?
Well, go ahead, Tom.
The first two were good. Yeah. I enjoyed them. But that last one with the little doll is
amazing. It's
incredible. Yeah. What a feat of TV movie making.
And I was like, when that came on, Rod, I was like maybe 11 when that debuted.
And I
was all over it because I was a horror fanatic. I've been a horror fanatic since birth. And so that doll one, man, I'll never forget it. I thought it was great. So anyway, did you buy Trilogy of Terror?
Well, I did, and so I watched it, and I also bought Terror Gardens and some old Hammer stuff, because I remember loving those as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And Trilogy of Terror, I agree, the first two were okay. That last one was mind-bending at the time. But I had to say, watching it now, there's a little part of me going, you thought this was amazing as a kid? I mean, it's good, but it's really dated-looking now. I mean, the film stock makes it look kind of, the lighting's kind of dingy, and the music was kind of jazzy and weird and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, there's all those moments where you're going, oh, don't be stupid, Karen. Oh, God, don't open the oven.
Yeah.
You know he's in there.
Yeah.
But that last thing where she's there, you know, driving the knife into the linoleum was just awesome. So, but I'll tell you what wasn't awesome was I also bought all three seasons or four seasons of Night Gallery, because I remember that being pretty good as a kid. That was Rod Serling's attempt at redoing Twilight Zone, and it just did not translate well into the late 60s.
I watched Night Gallery as a kid religiously, and there were a couple that, you know, and I have since seen it, and I have it holds a lot of sentimental value for me. I realize it's not very good. But it's a show that is a major part of my youth, of my childhood, and there was the one that I always remember that freaked me out so much was Sandra Locke was in it, and she went out on a date with a guy, and he was a jerk, and it didn't go well, but he gave her a brooch that looked like a bug slash a possum, and he took he put the brooch on her lapel. And took the pin out, but it still stuck. And he said it was a magic brooch. And as the date went worse, and he was giving her a ride home, and he made a move on her. She slapped him, and he kicked her out of the car. This is, of course, the early 70s when this stuff was not as politically incorrect as it is now. He kicks her out of the car, and as she's walking by herself home took place in England on the English countryside. She's walking home. The brooch begins to grow. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it's like this gigantic possum-looking thing that kills her. And I just remember seeing that, freaking out when I was a kid. And I've since watched it, and I still think it's pretty cool. But yeah,
of course, it got bigger in cutaways, right?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Nothing for special effects. My favorite was the one with the doll, and the old the British colonel who had done his turn in India.
Yeah.
The little girl gets that present from the same TV actor that we've seen in 8,000 bad TV shows.
Right, right.
But, that was pretty remarkable. Yeah, and then, of course, the end, you know, when the old guy's dead, he gets his revenge. But that was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But then you see some of the other ones where they were clearly on a single three-wall set for the whole 10-minute skit. And it's like, come on, you guys. At least leave the room once.
It was the strongest ones were in the first two seasons. By the time the third season, they had cut the budget. They actually split it. They turned it. It used to be an hour long, and then they flipped it to a half an hour and teamed it up with a show called The Sixth Sense with Gary Collins as a psychic.
Right,
and it was like this the Night Gallery Sixth Sense hour, and that's when the show was just. That's when they took all the budget away, and you know, because they had people like John Carradine in the first season, like some major names, and then it just didn't happen.
And who's Catherine? Was it Catherine Hepburn? No.
No.
There's, you know, the one I'm thinking of. The one, the pilot with the woman who has the bandages over her eyes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Oh, yeah.
Joan Crawford?
Joan Crawford. Yeah, Joan Crawford.
Yeah.
And so, but
and it
and
was
then,
directed
like,
by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, Spielberg got his start.
A big deal.
Spielberg got his start directing there. I think Joe Dante directed a couple of Night Galleries.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was practice for what they were eventually going to be good at. So
Joe Dante maybe should have just stuck with Night Gallery.
Joe Dante. I love Joe Dante. I love his
movies. I did visual effects on the worst pilot in television history that was a Joe Dante endless, you know, the money was just running down the drain like you can't believe, called The Osiris Chronicles. I think it was finally released as Battle for the Galaxy, Warlords Battle for the Galaxy. And it was
it had a couple of good things in it, but it was this really derivative of Star Wars kind of comic booky movie.
Yeah.
And we just, it's one of those things where you went to work month after month compositing effects and stuff and thinking, God, you know, if only there was a story to actually support all the cool work we're doing, it'd be kind of fun. But yeah, it didn't do well, unfortunately.
All right, Rod.
But I know he did some good stuff.
Hang on, Rod, okay?
All right.
Rod Pyle is with us. When we come back, we got to talk about his visit to the White House. He had dinner at the White House in between his last visit here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Wildcard Wednesday. Get your request in now. You're here, Wildcard Wednesday. That's any artist, any song, anything. We're currently hanging out with our good friend Rod Pyle. We're talking about space and some other stuff, too. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
So tell me about your trip to the White House. You had dinner there, and who were you with, and all that stuff.
I had lunch. So it was because at the conference, I had been at a conference a couple months before in Des Moines, and a friend of mine runs it, a guy named Tony Poston, runs this great conference. It's about 1,000 people. It's free. You know, he pays for everything. He raises money in the community, basically, to do this incredible innovation and creativity conference. And Al Worden from the Apollo 15 astronaut was there, along with Jerry Griffin and a couple others. So we invited Al and Jerry Griffin to come to the ISDC conference in Washington, D.C., and I'm not quite sure how it came about, but the next thing I knew, Tony's calling me and saying, hey, do you want to have lunch at the White House a couple of days? And I'm like, yeah. I said, "How? Why? You know, I mean, did they ask for me by name?" Which they didn't. He said, no, we're going because they want to meet Al Worden because he's Apollo 15 astronaut. So it turns out that a guy that works there, who is actually Trump's agency ethics official,
what?
Which has got to be a fascinating job.
It's got to be.
it was a friend of Tony's, and he's a space guy. So he said, yeah, come back for lunch. So we went through the whole thing. You got to go to the gate, and then you're in this kind of little airlock lock thing, and they scan you and pat you down and all that. And then you got to go through another thing and another thing. And finally, we're inside, walking through the grounds. There's black Suburbans everywhere. And saying, wow, this is the White House grounds. So you go to the White House. And I mean, I've, you know, been watching the West Wing for years, and I'm expecting this grand mansion. It's like going to your Aunt Martha's farmhouse. There's just more rooms, but little hallways, and you know, he takes us around. Okay, there's a situation room. There's the briefing room. We can go in there because nobody's using it. So we're going in, sitting in the chairs and stuff. And we went in the press room and got a picture of us all taken up at that podium we've seen a million times.
Sure.
But it's tiny.
Yeah.
And, you know, edges of it kind of run down. But the food was great. The lunch was fantastic, and that was... And the whole experience was just great and surreal, and Trump was out of town. He was in the U.K., so it was pretty quiet. But just being able to open the door and go...
It was pretty quiet. Oh,
well, I mean, for the White House, or what you expect, you know, but he's opened the door. Okay, that's the Situation Room. We can't go in because there's talk about all these really serious people wearing, you know, flak vests and stuff. And I'm like, okay, let's not go in there.
Yeah.
They may remember my record. I'm not sure if statute of limitations is up yet. So it was very cool.
That seems pretty cool.
So I was able to give a copy of my Space 2.0 and Apollo books to Trump and Pence's assistants, and then one to the chief of NASA in person. So that was worth going to D.C. just for that.
Oh, that's cool. Well, that sounds like a great trip.
Books,
it sounds like a great trip.
It was.
Yeah, okay.
It was. I'll do it again in a heartbeat.
Rod, hang on. We're going to go to the news tonight. We got a couple more quick stories to talk about, okay?
Okay.
Rod Pyle is with us. He's great. He is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra magazine, and a space expert. And talk or text us here at 312-981-7200. More to talk about after this.
There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our mind.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It's Wild Card Wednesday. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Yeah, man, Wild Card Wednesday. Get your requests in. Want any artist, any song, anything? 312-981-7200. All right. We've been hanging out with Rod Pyle this morning. Always a blast. He's an author, a journalist, a speaker, and he's an expert on space. And we've been talking about space news stories and taking your calls and your texts at 312-981-7200. A couple more stories quickly here before we let Rod go. Rod, thanks for hanging out with us. I appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. A couple of stories here There's an asteroid that's three times as long as a football field that's going to whiz by us tomorrow.
Yeah, so this is called 2008 KV2, and I just had a chance to look at it quickly, but it's a big sucker. It's 1,080 feet across, which is alarming if it was going to be any closer than it is, because the Chelyabinsk asteroid, which hit in, what was it, I think 2015 or 2013, something like that, was only about 60 feet wide, and that did $30 million worth of damage and, you know, wiped out buildings all over the time. Didn't wipe out, but broke windows and injured people and so forth. It left kind of a small hole in the ice, you know, so it was a big deal in effect, but not a big deal as an asteroid. So when you get to the 1,000 feet range, you're talking about a potential for a 5-mile wide crater. You know, clothing would ignite about 82 miles away. It'd have major climate effects and all that. So that's the bad news. The good news is, it's going to miss us by 4.2 million miles, as it does roughly every 6 months to a year. It's a frequent passer. That's about 17 times the distance of the moon, which is already really far away. So it's just, you know, it's not a close miss, as people like to call it, because it's more exciting. It's kind of like a stroll. It's not even a stroll through your neighborhood. It's a stroll through the other side of town. You're not even going to see it.
Yeah. And how you say, one more time, how often does it pass us?
I think they said some years twice, some years once, up to a year and a half. So it's kind of a regular period.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, they can track these things pretty well when they're that large.
Yeah.
And predict their course, and it's not destined to have an untoward meeting with us anytime soon. But that said, you know, one of these days, one of these things will. They could be traveling through space. We don't think it's going to be a problem while it's close miss. It could impact something and get knocked into a different trajectory, or we could just get it wrong, or we could not see it, because we still don't have enough telescopes doing enough work on this, and they're dark and they're hard to see because they're the same color as space, basically. A lot of them are very dark, almost black, dark gray.
Yeah.
And if you don't see it in time, you can't deflect it, and we still haven't perfected the technology to deflect it. So, yeah, some money is due there, and nobody's taking it seriously enough. Mm-hmm.
And so if the one for tomorrow, we don't have to call Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck, then we're okay.
Oh, good God. Talking about bad movies.
It's a terrible movie.
And if only it would work that way. But we talked about this on your show before. You know, there's a lot of things being looked at. There's a probe going out in a couple of years called DART, Double Asteroid Redirection Test. It's going to it's a kinetic impact, or the whole spacecraft is going to slam into this little moonlet that's orbiting an asteroid that's only about 50 feet across itself, I think, and see if I can knock it off trajectory a little bit. If that works, then we know we can nudge these things. If we see them soon enough, we give it a little nudge for it's coming right into the Earth, and it'll knock it off course enough that it won't impact. But we need to start working on rockets, and there's been some talk of using nuclear weapons, not to blow it up, but just to nudge it off course. So these are things we need to start testing. Because, it would be a really bad day if one of these suckers head down.
Yeah. Okay, well, we don't have to worry about it this Thursday. It's just going to pass us right by. So there.
Yeah, sorry, no excitement there.
Okay, what about this other story about two potentially life-friendly planets that have been found? What's the latest on this?
Well, we're still, you know, finding all these exoplanets, so they're up to over 4,000 confirmed ones now. And, you know, 20 years ago, there were zero, so this is pretty astonishing stuff. But this is 12 and a half light years away. You still can't see them. We don't have telescopes big enough to see them. So you have to kind of infer their existence by observing and deduction. So in this case, they were tracking over a number of years the motion of this star, which had only been discovered itself in 2003, because it's a red dwarf, so it's really faint, and although marginally closer than a lot of other stars, but still 12 light years is far away if you're a small dark red star. But they were able to track its motion, and you get these little irregularities over time in radial velocity, so it'll slow down a tiny bit. And we're talking about, you know, tiny, tiny measurements here, but it's enough to let you know that there are planets swinging around that star. So there could be errors here, but they think that they've got two exoplanets that are in the life-friendly zone because this star is a lot smaller than our sun, about a tenth the mass of the sun, and cooler, and much less gravitational effect, obviously. These planets actually have a year of 5 days for one, 11 days for the other, so they're orbiting really fast, but they're in the right part of the orbit around the sun that they could harbor liquid water and have a good temperature regime for life and so forth. What's kind of exciting about this, more than all this other stuff, is red dwarfs are much older. So this thing is probably 8 billion years old, which is about twice the age of our sun, which means if there is life on that planet, it's had a lot longer time to evolve and turn into whatever it turned into.
Uh-oh.
So fingers crossed, you know, this is a lot of guesswork, but they've been hanging around a long time, and they may have gone back to dinosaurs with ray guns, or they may have just never evolved at all. Who knows? But, you know, eventually we'll be able to start observing these things more directly with bigger telescopes. And then once you can see, if you can measure the spectra of the atmosphere, you can begin to see if there's any pollutants or anything that might indicate either basic life like methane, you know, would say, okay, there might be microbial life on this planet, or air pollution, which says, okay, there's people and technology and they'll probably wipe themselves out in 100 years. But for now, let's enjoy the show.
Oh, all right. It's fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating stuff.
Cool stuff.
Real quick text here. 847 area code says, can you ask your guests about Elon's Starlink Internet from Space project? It's like 60 satellites launched from the Falcon 9. How does it work? Will it be free? And who knows how Elon's mind works? Well, that last question I don't think anybody can answer, Rod.
Not even his two wives that he married three times. No. because he's Elon. He's got to do it different, right? So, yeah, they did this first launch. This is really a test launch to see if these things will work. So they released them at 120 miles altitude, maybe 180 miles, I think. And then they eventually maneuvered up to a higher orbit. So they're seeing how these things work. And the goal here is to put up to 12,000 of these things in low orbits, because normally geosynchronous satellites that we use for phones and so forth are out, so they sit in one spot in the sky, but they're 25,000 miles away from Earth, and there's this big lag time going back and forth. So if you want really fast broadband service, you want satellites just over maybe 180, 200 miles up, 225 miles, where you get no lag time. The downside is they're whizzing overhead real fast, so you've got to have a lot of them, thousands of them, so they just hand off to each other. So your signal, it's like driving real fast on the freeway or going from cell tower to cell tower. In this case, your signal is being passed from satellite to satellite. They're in all these different orbits, so they're basically covering the whole planet. So in sub-Saharan Africa, where they got no coverage, if you can afford $180 for a base station and a solar cell, now you've got internet. So, you know, part of this is obviously commercial in nature because it's going to charge money for the service. It's not free. But part of it also, I was interviewing a couple of years ago this big investor in SpaceX, Steve Jurvetson, who I've mentioned to you before, he's a multi-billionaire,
yeah,
who said, think of how this opens up the intellectual conversation on this planet. You get the billion-plus people that have really no access to internet, or at least not anything regular or sophisticated, who are now having this conversation. They're becoming educated. How many more Einsteins might be out there? I don't know how many Einsteins, but a lot of really innovative and fascinating people. So that was kind of arresting to me. And he's such a charismatic speaker that I think it had a big impact at the time. But when you think about it, this could really change things, and hopefully one of those people who's grown up in an area possibly that's been very, very impacted by climate change is going to figure out a solution for that problem and save us all, because otherwise, I think the last estimate I heard was we got about 70 years left on this planet.
Mm.
That's scary.
It is scary. It's very scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Now, but before we let you go, I want to make sure we talk about some of your projects that that are happening right now. Tell everybody about your latest books and how they can get them.
So latest books are Space 2.0, which came out in February, and the First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. I always have to think on the subtitle because it's kind of long,
yeah,
which came out in April. That thing's selling like gangbusters, and it was already selling great. I think they're in their fourth printing, but for some reason, I don't know why, the publisher cut the price in half, so it's like $15 now for this huge, oversized, gorgeous picture book.
Yeah.
So, on the downside, my royalties will be a little less, but on the upside, it's a lot cheaper to get.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then finally, Heroes of the Space Age came out about a month ago, and that's exactly what it sounds like. It's a bunch of really cool guys and ladies, some who you've heard of, some whom you probably haven't, but who made the space age what it was. So go out, buy often, buy many, give them to your friends, and more important than anything, please leave reviews. You know, probably close to 20,000 copies of the Apollo book sold. It's got 7 reviews. And it's like, I literally go to signings and say, I'm only going to sign this if you promise to review the book on Amazon.
Yeah.
I'll say something nice, you know. So that's my plea for the night.
Okay. All right. Make sure you leave a review. And I can just say that all your books are great, and that Apollo book particularly is really a beautiful, beautiful book. No question about it.
Well, thank you. Did you leave a review?
No, I didn't. Now I feel bad. Now I feel bad. I'll leave
there
a review for you. There you go. And then
awesome.
I want to get to
the
Nat Dio doc that you were working on, that you worked on, and it comes out finally on July 7th, which is the day after my birthday, Rod. So there you go.
Oh, happy birthday.
Well,
you're going to be 45?
54. I appreciate that.
54.
Yeah.
Well, I reversed the numbers for you.
Yeah, I appreciate
it. So, this was... It's the other net. It's the other Apollo documentary.
Right.
So the big one came out of the theaters a couple months ago. It was spectacular. But it was just Apollo 11. This one, you know, it's what you expect from National Geographic. It's big, expensive, splashy. It's going to be in the theaters and on TV. And it covers the whole space race. So it starts before Sputnik and ends after the end of Apollo. And so you get to see, in a sense, even though it's made by a different company, it's kind of a nice bookend of the one we've seen, because we've seen the definitive Apollo 11 documentary. This one now is, I think, the definitive overall Apollo documentary. And we worked really hard to find a lot of cool shots and so forth. I was a very minor player in it, but it was a thrill to be involved and just be able to kind of get down and roll around in all this old footage. And just it was a blast, because I can't watch that stuff enough, you know?
Yeah. All right, sounds great. So Nat Geo, it's going to be in theaters, and everything, you can see it on starting on July 7th. And that's another Apollo celebration for this. And the Apollo stuff is going crazy, as you know, Rod. Everybody is going nuts.
It is, and I kind of thought it was going to happen, and some of the publicity people I was working on were saying, it's going to be a big deal. But I tell you, I usually do a talk or two a month or something, and now it's like booked hour to hour. Some of them are paying gigs. I'm opening this show at the Pasadena Rose Bowl. They're doing this huge multimedia thing, and I'm talking to Buzz Aldrin and Charlie Duke and the one other astronaut. I forget which one, because it's all kind of running together. And then I'm doing a live radio broadcast from California Science Center on the landing anniversary day, which is July 20th. So it's a long stream of things that I'm involved with. So I'm really happy about it. And then, like I said, by late August, early September, I will have slid into obscurity again, but I'm digging it well here.
Well, very cool. All right. Listen, Rod, we will talk to you next month, and stay busy.
I will. Thanks very much. It's always fun.
Always a blast. Thanks, Rod. Take care.
Take care.
See you later. Rod Pyle, everybody. He's terrific. You can go to pilebooks.com. Or you can get his books anywhere. The books are sold online. He's a terrific writer, a great journalist, a really cool guy, and a very funny guy. And he also worked on special effects, as we've talked about. He worked on a lot of science fiction TV shows, science fiction movies, and stuff like that. Worked on TV, worked in movies, and was part of the world of special effects, which is what we're going to talk about after we break. But we're not going to talk about good special effects. We're going to talk about blockbusters that had the worst special effects, like, ever. And there are a lot of movies that have terrible special effects. And if you want to jump in with some that you've seen that you would like to throw into the mix, we are talking about, oh my God, those are the worst special effects I've ever seen in my life. And laugh out loud, terrible FX. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll jump into that right after we break here on 720 WGN.
I'm just walking my dog, singing my song. My life was lonely and blue. Yeah, I was sad as a sailor. I was an angry.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Wildcard Wednesday. You've been Wildcard Wednesday. Get your requests in. We'll play them. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Any artist, any song, anything. Who requested that?
So that's coming to us from Dave in Monroe, Wisconsin. It's called The Dog Song by Nellie McKay.
The Dog Song by Nellie McKay.
Yes.
Okay. Never heard that before.
First time.
Don't know it. Well, that happens a lot on Wild Card Wednesday. That's because it's wild and it's a card. I don't know. All right. Welcome back, everybody. We're going to talk about big budget movies, blockbusters that have terrible special effects, some of the worst effects that you could possibly imagine. What movies have you seen in the past where you go, okay, that was the worst special effect I've ever seen in my life? And we're doing this because we always have a lot of fun talking with Rod, not just about space, but the guy's an expert on a lot of stuff, and he's so entertaining. I love talking with Rod Pyle. He's one of my favorite guests. And he worked on special effects in movies and in science fiction stuff. And so I wanted to segue into some terrible special effects. 312-981-7200. Also, Big Brother debuted last night, so we're going to talk a little bit about the debut. I'm going to talk about the new cast members, the new house guests that were introduced to us last night. It's on again tonight as part of the two-part premiere. And we'll talk about that, and we're going to rank some of the past winners as well. Plus, we got another edition of Know Your Onion. Tom is your host, and he will read to you news headlines, and you have to tell us whether or not you think it's a real headline or it's a headline from The Onion, the fake news satirical comedy newspaper. So you answer, he'll read a headline, you answer real or onion, and if you get a majority of them right, you get a prize, and everybody goes away a winner. So we do this every Wednesday morning at 4:30, so that's coming up, so Know Your Onion will be coming up as well. So our phone number again is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, your wildcard Wednesday request, and your thoughts on some of the worst effects that you've ever seen in a movie. We're talking about some of the bigger budget ones, the ones where there's kind of no excuse. Because a lot of low-budget movies have terrible special effects.
Sure, yeah, it comes with the territory.
But sometimes they're kind of like, wait a minute, this is like a big movie. It's in thousands of theaters, and it's making a lot of money. And you couldn't improve the special effects at all? Now, these are both examples here that are legit, especially for the time that they came out. Because some of these, you know, some of them are older, and they should have had good special effects even back in the day. For instance, our first text that came through at 312-981-7200 is 724 area codes. Remember all the ridiculous hype over the 1976 King Kong movie? And then the special effects turned out to be such a letdown. Yeah. If you watch that 76 version of King Kong now, with the exception, the best special effect in it is Jeff Bridges' beard. That's the best special effect in the movie. When I was a kid, I thought it was fun because I loved King Kong. And I thought some of the effects were funny. I remember, you know, like when Jessica Lange, who plays the Fay Wray role in it, it was her first movie. Kong's got her in his hand, and like he gives her, like he puts her under a waterfall to wash her off, and then he blows on her to blow dry her. And I just remember like his cheeks got real big and. The makeup effects weren't that bad. The matte stuff was terrible. They had a big fake giant hand that she had to climb into, which looked like a big fake rubber giant stupid mechanical hand.
Yeah, it was very obvious.
Or paw, if you want. But the makeup effects were okay. Rick Baker did the makeup effects. Now, it was sort of early Rick Baker when, when he was a protege of oh my god, why am I blanking on one of the greatest Dick did effects for The Exorcist.
Oh,
one of the greatest special effects makeup guys of all time.
Dick Smith,
right. So Dick Smith, he was a protege of Dick Smith's at that time, and this was kind of his first big budget out on his own, and he's actually inside the mask. That's Rick Baker who's in the
wait
mask.
Rick Baker's in the
he's in the mask
he is
yeah.
the he is Kong
yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's Rick Baker. But when you look back at that movie, oh, man. It's not good. It's not a good movie. And second of all, the special effects. I enjoy sort of the makeup effects are fine, but, man, a lot of the miniatures and the matte paintings and stuff like that, which that was, at that time, that was the top quality special effects that were available. And not good. 608 area code says, bad effects, Tron. See, you know, I thought Tron, I mean, Tron's a stupid movie, but I thought some of the effects in Tron were pretty groundbreaking, and they were. You look at it now, and it looks stupid, but
right. But
back in the day, I thought the light cycle race thing was pretty cool.
That's the only good part about that movie.
Light cycle race? It's the best.
Is the special effects in
the look of it, the way it looks. Nothing else at that point, I fully admit this, nothing else looked like that before.
No.
And it was computer generated effects. Now, granted, it was 1982 era computer generated effects, but it was still computer generated effects, which is now the norm. So yeah. Tron, if it looks silly now, and it maybe looked a little silly back then, but it truly was groundbreaking.
It was denied a nomination by the Academy because they considered it cheating.
Yeah. They considered it cheating, and it didn't get the special effects. But again, if you look at it now, you're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
But that's true. But that's true of a lot of movies, you know, from the 70s and 80s. You look back at those effects now because they've improved so much. You know, like we saw Ghostbusters on the big screen, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And there are some effects in there that are like, ooh.
Yeah. But there are some that are just timeless.
There are some that are great, but there were some, you know, there were some that were like, there were specific shots of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man that were what?
Well, even the Slimer. Yeah. So, it's like,
Yeah. But we've moved on since then. So, all right. But some people haven't. Even big budget blockbusters have terrible special effects. What are the worst special effects you've ever seen? And we'll talk about this article from ScreenRant.com right after the news, which is coming up next on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, and we're here till 5 o'clock. It's Wednesday. That means Wildcard Wednesday. You mean Wildcard Wednesday? Get your requests in. Any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. All right. What was that? Who requested that?
So that was coming to us from Big Ed.
Big Ed.
That's ZZ Top and Jeff Beck with the song 16 Tons.
Okay. Jeff Beck and ZZ Top. All right. There you go. All right. We are talking about special effects in movies because we had our great friend Rod Pyle on, who has had experience working on special effects in science fiction movies and other things and TV shows. And so we thought we would talk about blockbuster movies that just had terrible effects. And what movies pop out with you? Like, what movies do you go, oh, my God, those are the worst special effects I've ever seen? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And here's Trucker Rich. Hi, Rich.
Hey, Nick. How are you doing tonight?
All right, buddy.
In case I don't get to you, because I'm off next week, and you're probably off next week for your birthday, but happy birthday.
Thank you, man. I will be off the 4th and the 5th. I will be off Thursday and Friday of next week. But I will be on. I will be on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Well, yeah, I'm off next week. Well, every place we deliver to shuts down prematurely, so I get a week off.
Okay,
my birthday's 3 days after yours.
Oh, is that right? Okay, yeah, happy birthday! Yeah, happy birthday to you too, Rich.
Thank you. But probably 10 years, 10 years earlier than yours. Yeah. But anyway, it was a TV show that I seen when I was a kid, and you were probably. I don't know if you saw it in reruns or not, but Buck Rogers.
Oh, sure.
I mean, you know, you saw the wires on the spaceship, and it never was smooth. It was always jerky, you know, and for the exhaust, it was just sparks, and then the smoke went straight up.
Right.
And I mean, even as a little kid, I thought, I've seen trains and airplanes, and when they go forwards, the smoke goes backwards, not straight up. You know?
That's pretty funny.
And all the... you know, in honor of Dan, all the Hallmark movies at Christmas time, the snow, I mean, come on, you can make something look a little bit better than just cotton and shaving cream on the ground when people walk through the Hallmark.
Well, I mean, Winter Wonderland. You know, they make so many of those movies that you know, it's like, look, our budget for snow just decreases and decreases because they make like 90 a year of those things. And they start showing them next month. They start showing the Christmas movies, the Hallmark Christmas movies, or the Lifetime, whichever one of those. I think it's Hallmark Christmas movies. Yeah. They start showing them next month, like first run.
Yeah, Christmas in July.
It's insane.
Well, some of them are all right. You know, mindless time killers. But I mean, you can at least have plastic confetti. Instead of shaving cream on the ground.
Right.
You know. So. All right.
Thank you. All right, Rich. Take care, buddy.
Yep. Bye bye.
We got some texts here. 847 area code. The 1979 movie Star Crash with David Hasselhoff and Carolyn Monroe had terrible special effects. Marjo Gortner was the star of that movie, and Carolyn Monroe. Don't speak ill of Carolyn Monroe. Tom, you're familiar with Carolyn Monroe.
Yes. Yeah.
Don't even go there. She's a Hammer horror girl, man. She was a Bond girl.
I know.
And when I was a kid and I saw her, I was like, hey, what's happening to me right now? I don't understand these feelings that I'm feeling right now.
Yeah.
When I look at this woman, Carolyn Monroe. And if you want to see what she looks like, her last name is M-U-N-R-O. M-U-N-R-O, Carolyn Monroe.
Yeah, I just misspelled that in the Google search.
She is a spectacularly attractive woman. And still does the convention. She's never done Flashback.
Ah, you'll get her.
She's never done Flashback.
You'll get her.
But yeah, Star Crash is a terrible movie. Did you ever see this? You watch Mystery Science, right?
Yep.
Do you ever see the episode where they do Star Crash?
I have not seen that one. I know it's been on a DVD. Like, I borrowed my friends. They've got it on DVD or something like that. And I think they've got the one with Star Crash on it.
It's hilarious because the movie's awful. I mean, she's got some fantastic outfits that she wears in the movie. And it's always an unbelievable, pleasant experience to look at Carolyn Monroe. But... man, is Star Crash bad. But they do it. MST3K, it's a fantastic episode. It is hilarious because it's an awful movie. And again, this was like when everybody on Earth was making cheap, stupid-looking Star Wars ripoffs. 708 area code says the special editions of the original Star Wars films, the 1997 re-releases. They were kind of stupid. I did like the one where they open up the door and there are like 9,000 stormtroopers in the room. Because there were like when in the original cut there's like 5, but they added like 150 stormtroopers.
I can hear George Lucas now. Yeah. Let's just double that up.
Well, it just cracked me up. The first time I saw the This is in the first Star Wars movie, or the fourth, whatever the hell it is.
Star Wars,
whatever the hell that is. There's some
very 90s CGI that gets shoehorned in.
Yeah.
And now he's just like, yeah, I'm not changing it.
Yeah.
This is my movie now.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when they re-released him, though, that's when the hype machine began big time for Phantom Menace. That's when they re-released the first three in the theaters in 97 all the way through the beginning like of 98. Because Phantom Menace came out in 99. The hype machine for that went into overdrive. And a lot of young people who had never seen the movies before saw the re-releases of the Star Wars movie, of the first three. And it was guaranteed that, you know, with another year and a half of hype.
Oh yeah. The only change that I think was really warranted was in Empire, they changed there's a bit where Darth Vader's like talking to the Emperor and they change it so that it's Ian McDiarmid. Because before that it was some other actor. They had Cassian as the actual Emperor. So they changed it so that would be consistent. That's the only thing that was like, yeah.
I'll tell you what special effect completely freaked me out, considering one of my heroes in the history of all humankind is Peter Cushing. And, you know, Peter Cushing was in the original Star Wars as
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Okay. That guy. That's Peter Cushing. And I felt really weird and kind of giddy and kind of sick to my stomach watching Rogue One, because they kind of brought Peter Cushing back to life through CGI.
It's wild.
It was weird, man. I mean, because this guy, and I'm not exaggerating, Tom. He's one of my heroes.
One of my heroes. You got the statue.
I do. The Van Helsing statue right on my end table next to my couch, right next to my couch. And I just love him. I love Peter Cushing. And, you know, he's been dead for a very long time. He died in 1994. And so when Rogue One came out and I had heard that they used CGI to actually put Peter Cushing back into the movie, I was like, eh. And then I'm friends with the British man who runs the Peter Cushing Appreciation Society. I've had him on the show several times. We need to get him back on. Mm-hmm. I think he lives here now because I think he moved back to the States. And I think he lives in Chicago, or at least the last time we talked. And the family of Peter Cushing and the estate, they were invited to see the movie and they approved. So when I heard that, I was like, okay. And then I saw it and it was weird. I got to tell you, just to see Peter Cushing, and I mean, they did an unbelievable job. And the voice the voice sounded exactly like Peter Cushing, because they had an actor who could do an unbelievable Peter Cushing, provide the vocals for it. And I just felt it just was very strange. I've seen Rogue One 3-4 times, and it's all every time I see those scenes with Cushing, I'm like, oh man, that's it's awesome and weird, and I might cry. And
and then even later when they do, oh my god, Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not sure if she had passed at that point when they actually did it. They just needed to have a young Carrie Fisher to be consistent with their timeline.
Yeah.
And they did the same thing.
Well, that's like, in Rogue One, too. Yeah. It's at the final scene. Shocking. The end of Rogue One.
Yeah, which goes right into the original Star Wars.
Rogue One is, I think Rogue One's a really terrific movie.
Man. You know, they're showing it with a very rare 70mm print of the original Star Wars in L.A. this weekend.
They're showing Rogue One?
Yeah, they're going to show Rogue One
and then
into Star Wars in 70mm.
That's pretty cool.
That's amazing.
That's pretty cool. Even as not a big Star Wars fan, that's pretty cool. Yeah, no, I just really, really love Rogue One. It's my favorite of any Star Wars movie of all of them. I'm including the first three. Yeah, I just love it. Everybody dies. We have a text here from the 404 area code, and it just so happens to be the first one mentioned in our article.
Ah.
And that would be The Mummy Returns. The Mummy Returns, all the special effects of The Rock as the Scorpion King are so awful. And I'm looking at, because in the article they have like a picture, an example of why the special effect is bad, and it's terrible. The CGI version of the Scorpion King is terrible. So here's how they describe it. So not only did our listener agree with this, but so did the people who put this article together at Screen Rant. No list of CG disasters is complete without The Mummy Returns, which ends with a fight between Brendan Fraser and Dwayne The Rock Johnson's face mapped onto the body of a scorpion, which looks kind of like a lobster, a lobster centaur. To say that the Scorpion King looks weird is an understatement. The face is glossier than more plastic, and more plastic looking than all the Real Housewives combined. The body is a little bit more realistic, but it still looks artificial compared to everything else on screen. Even with the CGI fail, The Mummy Returns ended up grossing $433 million worldwide. However, the $98 million budget, one would think that they could have had money to create some convincing adversary in the finale.
Yeah, because the first one of that revival had some pretty good special effects.
Yeah.
For 1999.
Well, I like both of those movies.
I think they're pretty good.
I like both. I like the Scorpion King too.
You're into the Scorpion King?
Oh, I like the Scorpion King. I like that movie.
What about, do you know how many sequels there are to that?
Well,
it's got its whole own series.
The Scorpion King?
Yeah, there's Scorpion King 2 through 4, I want
to
say.
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with The Rock.
No, The Rock is not in them.
Because he went on, he's going on to be pretty big.
Yeah. Well, he's done, even though he's got his Fast and the Furious spinoff, he's not going to be in Fast 9.
He's not?
Nope. And the cast seems to be pretty like chill with it. They weren't super happy with how much he wanted the franchise to be about him.
Well, he also didn't get along with Vin Diesel, and that's been well documented.
Yeah.
At all.
That's why he's getting his own side thing with Jason Statham.
Yeah. That movie looks completely ridiculous.
So I'm in. I'm all in. Give me the chips. I'm going all in.
It looks unbelievably ridiculous. But all of those movies are ridiculous in a good way. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of that series.
Yeah, Point Break with cars.
Yeah. Well, the first one.
Yes.
The first one is Point Break with cars. And that's exactly what it is. It's the same plot. So, except for robbing banks, they're just street racers, right?
Yeah. Well, they're stealing I think they're stealing DVD players,
something along those lines.
Which is a very 2001 plot.
Yeah. So, all right. Bad special effects in movies. Screen Rant is the article that we're reading from, and they've got some really fun ones here. Blockbuster movies at whatever time, whatever decade, whatever time period that they were released, they could have done better with their special effects, but they did really, really poorly. So terrible special effects in movies. 312-981-7200. We'll get back to it after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Wildcard Wednesday. You mean Wildcard Wednesday? Who requested the theme from Stripes by Elmer Bernstein?
Let me get my little list right here.
Okay.
It was an excellent track. That was Steve.
Steve, yeah. Picking the theme from Stripes there.
Yeah, special one just for you.
Thank you. All right. Welcome back, everybody. 312-981-7200. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. And we're talking about movies with terrible special effects, even if they had a pretty good budget. Terrible special effects. The next one that Screen Rant brings up is RoboCop. And the scene that they're specifically talking about is bad. I have to agree with it. But RoboCop is one of my favorites. I adore that movie.
Great flick.
It's a great movie. And here's what they say on screen on a Screen Rant. Regarded by many critics as one of the best movies made in 1987, one of the top action movies ever made, RoboCop is a smart sci-fi thriller that uses over-the-top gore and violence to satirize American culture. The film was nominated for two Academy Awards, including Sound Effects Editing and Best Sound, and it took home the editing prize. RoboCop was made on an estimated $13 million budget, which was pretty modest considering the attention to detail that went into creating the enforcement droid ED-209 prototype and stop-motion effects. While the effects in RoboCop were mostly acceptable at the time, stop-motion would soon be replaced by CGI. The scene in which the evil corporate heavy Dick Jones, played by Ronnie Cox, falls to his death from a skyscraper is egregiously bad. A dummy was used to film the scene, but it would have been more realistic had the dummy not had arms the same length as his body. They pulled a screenshot from it. It is absolutely ridiculous. But I don't care. I love that movie.
Yeah, when he gets all shot up.
Yeah.
That was some pretty good special effects right there.
Well, you know, that scene is so brutal. The scene where they shoot him, you know, just repeatedly. I remember just like viscerally just going, whoa. And
it's a lot.
It is a lot. And I told you the story about when I screened it at my film club. Eric Childress was sitting behind me, and we're in the boardroom scene at the beginning of the movie when the robot goes nuts and starts blowing away the guy. And it was at gunshot number 800 or whatever, when we both went, oh my God, it's the X-rated version. Because I had no idea I was screening the X-rated version. It wasn't until that scene. The X-rated version is like even more violent than the R-rated version. And the R-rated version is already like truly one of the most violent movies I've ever seen. But the X-rated version takes it an even further. And so Eric and I, of course, got all giddy. So everybody else in the theater who had never seen it before, I told them afterwards, I was like, "That, by the way, I just want to let everybody know, because I do my talk after the movie, I was like, that was the X-rated version, and people were like, good Lord.
I'm sure the traumatized 8-year-old was...
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, as soon as they cut to another angle of this guy being multiply shot, and then cut to another angle, and then cut to yet another angle, I was like, oh boy, this is the X-rated version. All right, here's Big Ed on WGN. Hi, Ed.
Hello, Nick.
Hey.
You were talking about that 76 Kong.
King Kong, yeah.
And the one thing that I remember, which I thought was really, really ridiculous, you remember the scene where he goes from one trade center to the other?
Yeah.
Where he jumps?
Yeah.
He looks like he's flying like Superman.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a jump. It was like he's flying. I was like, what is this?
Yeah. No, it was not good. It was not good. Not at all. So, all right, Big Ed.
Okay,
thanks, man.
See ya.
Take care. Jumping from one World Trade Center to the other, King Kong. That's how they modernized it. You know, because the World Trade Center was built in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And so that movie came out in 1976. So it was a pretty relatively sort of kind of new buildings. So they thought, okay, instead of the Empire State Building, we can make it more modern. These buildings were built like 6 years ago, so let's put King Kong on the World Trade Center.
That'd be fresh.
And you've seen the poster for the 76, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because he's got 1 foot on one tower and 1 foot on the other. That's how big they made him. That's how big they made King Kong.
I remember
for the movie. It's a great movie poster. Don't get me wrong. It is a great movie poster, but
it's one of those things where you got to do a size comparison to like how big the original Kong is supposed to be versus this Kong versus Peter Jackson's Kong.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like Godzilla varies in style too.
Yeah,
and in size.
Skull Island Kong, I think, is supposed to be really big.
Skull Island Kong's the biggest Kong.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, because he's got to fight Godzilla.
Yeah.
And they've made Godzilla astronomically
huge. They've made it just massive. But yeah. Let's see. Special effects, 309 area code says, the 1981 Clash of the Titans, awful. I totally disagree. That's Ray Harryhausen, one of the greatest stop motion effect artists and most influential and groundbreaking of all time. I love the effects in Clash of the Titans. They remind me of the old Sinbad movies that Ray Harryhausen did. I love that stuff. I love the stop motion Ray Harryhausen stuff. Yes. Sven just showed Beast from 20,000 Fathoms last Saturday.
Yeah.
Early Ray Harryhausen. All the effects in that are a blast.
I mean, ask any special effects artist. They'll probably list Ray Harryhausen as like one of their biggest influences.
There's no question about it. His impact on movies and on special effects and film are just immeasurable. 773 area code says, hey, Nick, how about the nonsense on Lost in Space? Well, if we're talking about the TV show, had a budget of like, every episode had a budget of like a buck. The effects on the Lost in Space TV show are ridiculous. Oh no, look at the creature. Oh no. 815 area code, the Hulk with Eric Bana. Yeah, special effects weren't very good. I like that movie. I'm in the minority. I love that movie. Green Lantern with Ryan Reynolds. That won't be the last time we hear Green Lantern mentioned in this article. And then 815 area code, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, not a big fan of the graphics. That's another Ray Harryhausen movie. What the hell is wrong with people?
Mm. Well, I guess it's like by today's standards.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's dated, but it's Ray Harryhausen.
Speaking of Green Lantern, you know who's in that? Taika Waititi.
Is in the Ryan Reynolds?
Yep.
I don't even remember.
Plays his best buddy.
I don't remember anything about that movie. I remember Peter Sarsgaard's head gets big.
Oh, yeah, when he's Sinestro?
Yeah, it's the only thing I remember is Peter Sarsgaard, because Peter Sarsgaard's like one of my favorite actors that's ever lived on the planet, and I was really looking forward to him being the villain, and I was like, what the hell is happening? Because I don't know the Green Lantern from, you know, Johnny Quest. I don't know. But I remember when they made a big deal out of the Hulk, when the Hulk first came out, they teased it on the Super Bowl. It's like 6 months before it came out. You know how they do that.
Yeah.
And I was at a Super Bowl party with a bunch of friends and three or four comic book people in there. And they showed the trailer and they hadn't finished the special effects weren't finished at that point. And at one point, he's like jumping around like the Hulk does like big jumps in that movie, like big jumps.
Yeah.
And they had like a quick cut that they showed in the Super Bowl trailer where he's doing that. My friend goes, he looks like Q-Bert. That's what I kept thinking. He looks like Q-Bert. I'm like, all right, let's take a break. The news is coming up next, and then more terrible special effects in blockbuster movies. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. And, yeah, it's Wednesday morning, Wildcard Wednesday.
Give me a Wildcard Wednesday.
That's any artist, any song. Get your requests in now. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Who requested that?
That was Paul in Maryland wanting to hear The Ventures, Sold Breeze.
There you go. Oh. All right. Welcome back, everybody. And we are talking about terrible special effects in blockbuster movies. And you ever sit in a movie and go, what is that effect? That's kind of what we're talking about. If you want to jump in for talk or text with your contributions, it's 312-981-7200. Next up here is Freddy vs. Jason, which is another movie that I liked.
Yeah, I like that.
I like Freddy vs. Jason. I thought... Was it Ronnie Yu directed that movie?
Yeah. Was that 03, 04?
03, yeah.
Okay.
Because both movies have different styles to them. But I thought they did the style of each movie perfectly and kind of combined them. And I liked it. I like the fact that Jason just became sort of the dumb victim He was just like, oh, poor Jason. Like, that's
they kind of made it, and this is a compliment. It's like a episode of the Looney Tunes at times.
Well,
it's like totally goofy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that was the tone he was shooting for.
It worked.
I liked it. I'm a fan of it. After fans of the Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th franchises campaigned for a crossover film depicting a fight between Freddy and Jason, New Line and Paramount tried to make Freddy vs. Jason a movie in 1987. But the two studios failed to agree on a story. After 15 years of on-and-off development, approximately $6 million spent on 18 unused scripts from more than a dozen screenwriters. Wow. New Line finally produced Freddy vs. Jason in 2003. After years of anticipation, many fans were disappointed by the horrible plot and shoddy effects throughout. I wasn't. I do remember this scene, though, that they're about to describe. And it's pretty bad. Throughout the Nightmare on Elm Street film series, Freddy Krueger focuses on the respective person's biggest fears to come up with the inventive ways to kill them in their own dreams because of their fears. While there are many creative ways a serial killer has enticed his victims throughout the years, the weed caterpillar takes home the prize in stupidity. Character Mark Davis is a stoner, so Freddy waits for him to light up a joint before making his move, which is to take the form of a caterpillar with a bong, which isn't even remotely scary. The weed caterpillar is one of the most idiotic CGI monsters to appear on screen. Yeah, it's pretty silly. But there are a lot of silly stuff in the Nightmare series, Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Was he pretty deep into it?
Yeah.
Isn't there one where he turns into a TV?
Yeah. Well, he's in the TV, he takes he's got the antenna coming out of his head.
Yeah.
And he takes the victim and smashes him through the TV.
Yeah. I like that one.
I like the one where and by the way, this girl, the actress, has been announced that she's coming to Flashback. I like the one where the weightlifting girl turns into a cockroach.
Yep. Yep.
And then is in the giant roach motel. That I just, I love that one. And she's been announced. She's coming to Flashback.
All right.
Tons of Nightmare people coming. The beautiful Lisa Zane, Billy Zane's sister, who was in the last one. It was supposed to be the last one. Freddy's Dead. She's coming.
Very nice.
And I have not seen her. She and I know each other. I have not seen her in maybe 23, 24 years.
I'm just ready to meet Robert for the first time.
Yeah, I've met him.
I know. It's old hat to you.
Well,
Nick.
But he's been to Flashback. I think of all the big, you know, sort of iconic people.
Sure.
He's been there the most. I mean, I don't even know how many times he was there 2 years ago.
He's for the fans, man. He's always struck me as that type of guy.
Yeah. He's always been very supportive of this specific convention. How about Ghostbusters 2? After the success of the original Ghostbusters, producer-director Ivan Reitman and writers Dan Aykroyd and Hal Ramis were pressured to make a sequel by Columbia Pictures. While initially hesitant, Reitman, Aykroyd, and Ramis eventually signed on. It's not nearly as well-liked as its predecessor, but Ghostbusters 2 grossed nearly $30 million this opening weekend and almost $250 million worldwide. One of the more memorable scenes... in the movie is when the four Ghostbusters bring the Statue of Liberty to life by using the positively charged psychomagnetronic slime and Howard Hunsberry's Higher and Higher. While a lot of work went into the scene, including the use of miniatures, a large head sculpture for close-up shots, and some full-scale set pieces, the long shots make it obvious that the statue is merely a man in a costume. I have not seen Ghostbusters 2 in many years.
I picked up that 4K set of the original Ghostbusters, and then they make you get Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah.
I did go up to the clerk. I was like, can I just leave this disc here?
Yeah.
No.
So it's a fun fact. Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis originally conceived the idea of the Statue of Liberty as a force of evil used by Vigo, but out of respect to Lady Liberty, they decided to make her a positive influence. The only thing I remember about Ghostbusters 2, and I mentioned this before, the only thing I remember about Ghostbusters 2 is... Peter McNichol. He's the only... I remember him being really great in it.
Probably the most memorable part.
Yeah.
You are correct.
Total Recall. They're dissing on Total Recall, man.
I think that's a mistake. This should not be on this list.
Rob Bottin, man. Don't be messing with Rob Bottin.
No.
Yeah, Rob Bottin did the effects. I personally love my favorite effect in the movie, which, of course, you know... I love the fact I like when they're when you know, like Arnold is out in the atmosphere of Mars and he goes and his eyes start bugging out and his tongue is sticking out of his head. And then, of course, you know, once he gets once everything happens, he goes back to normal. Like all of that, like that would there'd be no damage. His eyes were sticking. His eyes are like 3 feet out of his head. His tongue has swollen. It's ridiculous. But that's how Ronnie Cox dies.
Yeah,
in that movie, another Verhoeven movie with Ronnie Cox. But I think they're specifically talking about the scene where Arnold's disguised as the fat lady. In the terminal,
I think it's I can
like
see
it.
Why it works.
I like
I
it.
Think it works.
I don't care. I like it because I love that movie. I love Total Recall. I think that movie's insane.
Yeah, we can remember it for you wholesale.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, nothing like what Philip K. Dick wrote. The closest thing to a Philip K. Dick that's ever been filmed, is the Linkletter.
Oh, Scanner Darkly.
That's it. That's the That's the closest. And as great as Total Recall is, and as great as the other movies are, and as great as Blade Runner is, not even close to what Philip K. Dick wrote.
No.
Not even close. $65 million, Total Recall was one of the most expensive films ever made at the time of its release, and you can tell that most of the money was put into the film's visual effects. Total Recall was one of the last major Hollywood blockbusters to use large-scale miniature effects rather than computer-generated imagery. Five different companies were brought in to handle the effects. But the only CG was used for the X-ray skeletons in the computer for the concealed weapons. That's the only CG that they used. Total Recall was given the Special Achievement Academy Award for Visual Effects. While most of the effects in the movie are inspiring and imaginative, that's not the case for one particular scene. When Arnold ditches the fat woman disguise, it starts to malfunction. He, or something that resembles him, is revealed to be underneath. The head is clearly a model and not a good one.
Did you know that Arnold Schwarzenegger's memoir is called Total Recall?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I'm glad he didn't call it Predator.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, he could have.
Jingle all the way.
Yeah. How about this? The Fugitive. What scene are they, what are they talking about in The Fugitive? The Fugitive is based on the 1960s television series of the same name created by Roy Huggins. The film spent 6 weeks as the number one. Wow, 6 weeks as the number one film, and it grossed nearly $369 million with a budget of $44 million. The film was nominated for 6 Academy Awards. Tommy Lee Jones took home the award for Best Supporting Actor. The film did not receive a nomination for visual effects. Not to say that there were none. The scene where the train crashes into the bus is remarkable, especially considering it was filmed in one take. The sequence cost $1 million and 13 cameras to film, three of which were destroyed in the process. Wow. Some awe-inspiring effects did not translate into the scene where Harrison Ford's character jumps off the hydraulic off of the hydraulic dam. Viewers have noted that the body taking the plunge down the waterfall looks like a dummy, and they're correct. I haven't seen the movie in a while. Now I want to go back and watch.
Yeah.
It says, in fact, there were 6 dummies that were used at a cost of $12,000 a pop.
You serious?
$12,000 a pop. I've not seen that movie in a while. I love The Fugitive. I guess I never noticed that it looks terrible when he jumps off. For $12,000 a pop.
Man, you couldn't even get a good dummy for $12,000.
Oh, man. All right. All right, let's take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk more terrible special effects in movies. 312-981-7200.
The solemn moon casts dark shadows over the placid stillness of the old mansion. I, Barnabas, lie in deep sleep on my bed of purple velvet. Asleep, but awake to your thoughts, your feelings, your desires.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Wild Card Wednesday. Yeah, man, Wild Card Wednesday. 312-981-7200. Any artist, any song, anything. Who requested that?
That was from Kathy. An excellent request from Kathy.
There you go. A little Barnabas action for you. Right
there. Little Barnabas action.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 o'clock. Coming up, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. Also coming up, The Stories That Matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We talked with Rod Pyle. It was always a blast to talk with him. And he used to work on special effects on movies and TV shows. So we thought we'd segue into blockbusters that had really, really terrible special effects. And that's what we're talking about right now. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Here's Donald on WGN. Hi, Donald.
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking of the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, you know, the much-anticipated Indiana Jones. It just looked like they were flipping certain scenes. It looked like they were just flipping cards or something, you know. I mean, it didn't look real at all compared to the earlier films.
No, everything about that movie stunk. It was a terrible movie, and the special effects were atrocious.
Yes, they were in
so many scenes. I mean, the first thing that pops into my head about that concerns bad special effects in that movie are when Shia LaBeouf is flying around with monkeys, jumping from like tree to tree to tree. I just remember that being just absurd and looked terrible.
Right. Yeah. Nobody, bring back Hollywood stuntmen. Right.
Yeah. All right, Donald.
Don't do that.
Thanks, Bond. Take care.
Okay.
All right. There you go. That movie just stunk. And I can't believe they're going to make another one.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even fathom why.
I remember the day I saw that. It was at the Marcus Theaters in Addison, Illinois.
Yeah.
With my cousins. And it was really bad. So I think, I can't remember if there was, this might have been a different time, but I'm pretty sure we went out there and snuck in to go see Jackass 3 or something like that. We had a great time.
Yeah. Well, that's, you needed that as a palate cleanser.
Well, that's one way
to cleanse the glass. My friends and I went with a big group. My friends and I went down to Ricochet's and got loaded because we saw it at the Davis. We were like, let's go drink now because that was terrible. All right, next here in the screen rant, and I'm not happy, Escape from L.A.
you have to admit they're pretty bad.
I don't care.
I love that movie.
I love that movie, and I don't care. It's Escape from L.A., a sequel to Escape from New York, was a box office bomb, earning roughly $25.5 million with a $50 million budget. Albeit receiving mixed reviews, many fans revere Escape from L.A. for its campiness. Still, critics and viewers alike have noted that the film is missing the dark post-apocalyptic atmosphere of the first Escape movie. Even the director, John Carpenter, thought the script for the second Escape movie was hard to take seriously. The campiness is evident throughout the film, especially in the scene where Kurt Russell and Peter Fonda hang. Yeah, it's pretty cheesy, but I don't care. Peter Fonda and Kurt Russell hang 10 on a tsunami wave. While the scene is playful and humorous, the effects are downright cheesy, and perhaps that's the point. Viewers can tell that the film is making fun of itself, considering the film was made in 1996. However, you'd think they would have a bit more artistry in the sequence.
And the submarine he's in, that snake's in, when he jumps onto the...
Yeah.
Ooh, that's rough.
I don't care. I love that movie.
I know.
The aforementioned Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is next. It was a financial success, grossing over $786 million worldwide. Oh, my God. Becoming the franchise's highest grossing film. And the second highest grossing of the film of 2008. Spielberg stated before the production that he had very few CG effects that would be used to maintain with his other films. However, specifically, more CGI work was done during the film. There ended up being a total of 450 CGI shots in the film, and an estimated 30% of the film's shots contained CG matte paintings. While there was an abundance of CGI in the film, it was evident that when some of the Soviet villains were eaten alive by a swarm of red ants, the fourth film strayed from the old-fashioned adventure of its predecessors, and fans were disappointed. I don't even remember the red ants. How about this one, Air Force One? Box office success with decent reviews. Air Force One was the most popular one. There's the ending crash sequence. For a big-budget blockbuster, you would expect more from a CGI sequence. The plane bounces on the water a couple of times and then takes the cheesiest nosedive into the ocean where it proceeds to break in half. It looks like something you would see in an old video game. I don't even remember that. Deep Blue Sea. Hey, now. Don't be messing around with Deep Blue Sea. While the movie sounds terrifying, the actual film was not so much. It was campy. It was full of cheesy dialogue. I love that movie. The scene where Samuel L. Jackson's character meets his demise is shocking simply for the fact that he is killed very early in the film, but it's also very amusing. What is unconvincing, though, is the CG shark dives behind, grabs him up by his teeth, and the next sequence viewers shoot the shark tromping away on a mannequin that is clearly Jackson's likeness. Blade 2, they're dissing on Blade 2.
Wrong. Incorrect.
Though financially successful, viewers may have noted that many of the fight scenes feel video game cutscenes. It was certainly the case early in the film when the band of vampire ninjas attack Blade in his industrial bat cave. Directed by Guillermo del Toro. They were disappointed with that.
Nah, I think it looks great.
Catwoman. The film was banking on the appeal of Halle Berry, but she was animated for most of her scenes. Her movements were odd and disjointed. What the CGI in Catwoman lacks in quality, it more than makes up for in quantity. In addition to a CG Catwoman, there are dozens of other poorly executed CGI sequences, including sweeps of the city, several cats, a spider, and even a seagull that attacks Barry. King Kong 2005. No. The scene in question is when the film crew sets out to explore Skull Island and gets caught up by a group of Tyrannosaurus Rexes chasing down their prey. Various times in the sequence, it's hard for the viewer to believe that the actors are in any danger, as it's clear that they're running in front of a green screen and the dinosaurs were pasted in the back.
I disagree. Who wrote this list?
It's a group of people from Screen Rant. I Am Legend. The Dark Seekers. They're making fun of the Dark Seekers there. And then finally, the worst is Green Lantern. Green Lantern received generally negative reviews, primarily for its screenplay, deviations from the comics, and choice of cast and villains, and the overuse of CG. It grossed $220 million, but it had a budget of $200 million. With such a large budget, it's disappointing that the film had some of the shoddiest CG in recent film history. The worst decision may have been to have Hal's suit company CG, as it called it, makes him look flat-out silly, especially with the pulsating light. Superheroes should look commanding, but the suit made the Green Lantern look like a light fixture at an electronic dance party. The suit detracts from the movie rather than adding value. So, there you go.
Script probably didn't help either.
Yeah, that
or
was
the performances.
That was not good. It's not a surprise to anybody, right, that I'm bringing that up, but it was not good. So, all right, there they are, some of the worst special effects in movie history. We are going to do some Big Brother talk if you want to join us after the news. Big Brother premiered last night. The part two of the big premiere is tonight at 7 o'clock. I watched, of course, because I watch, you know, if you're a regular listener, you know that every summer I watch every single episode of Big Brother, and I love it. And I've already got some opinions on some of the new house guests. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, and then we're going to jump over to try and rank some of the past winners of Big Brother. So that's all coming up on the show. Big Brother talk coming up after this. If you watched it last night, please give us a call or a text at 312-981-7200. News after this.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
I went hiking. The classic. With Joe Spivey. Who requested the Alan Sherman?
That was Glenn. It seems apropos for the topic.
You know, it's funny. In the play that I did, the vinyl shop, we brought in records for the set. Like, so I brought in a whole bunch of records. I brought in a whole, you know, like cast members brought in records just so we could fill the whole set with vinyl, you know? And it was a small set because it was, you know, but we built a big cart that was supposed to be the racks. So we had two separate racks, and everybody brought in vinyl. And someone, I can't remember who it was. I want to say it was Matt, who played Barry, brought in the album. You know, you have to look up the album cover in order to enjoy this. Oh, wait, you saw the video of Vinyl Shop?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We put it up on display for behind the counter because we had like a bunch of shelves and we put stuff on display. And the album cover, if you look it up, is one of the greatest album covers of all time. Alan Sherman, My Son, The Nut.
Yeah.
It's the it's one of the greatest album covers of all time. So we put it up on the set prominently, like right behind the counter, because there's so much dialogue that happens, you know, there. And I wanted to make sure that everybody got a chance to see it. And so Matt would take it down. There's a scene where in the play, because the album cover is spectacular. If you want to, you guys, if you want to Google image search it, Alan Sherman, My Son the Nut. It's one of the greatest album covers of all time. One of the most ridiculous album covers of all time. Have you Google search?
Oh yeah, no, I've got it.
It's fantastic. So there was a scene in the movie where Matt, as Barry, a couple comes in, kind of like a yuppie couple comes into the record shop. And then he kind of works them and wants them to buy stuff. He's like, you know, so he gets them to buy this thing called Barry Starter Kit. And it's a whole bunch of records and cassettes and stuff because these people have no musical taste. And so he's like, yes, as an extra bonus, he would do this because Heather Donaldson, it was an easy break. She was easy to break on stage. Terrific actress, but she broke a lot on stage. And I'm not one to preach because I break all the time on stage. But anyway, so at one point, like, because everybody thought the album cover was ridiculous. The entire cast, everybody involved in the play, thought it was one of the most ridiculous and funniest album covers ever. So Matt would pull the album cover down, and he'd go, and as an extra bonus, because it's a milk crate full of stuff that he's selling them. And as an extra bonus, he'd pull it off the counter and stick it in Heather's face and go, "My son, the nut." And then she'd bust out laughing every single time. She would bust out laughing every single time.
Well, it's just Alan Sherman poking out of
what looks like just a bunch of walnuts.
Yeah, it's just like a truckload of walnuts.
Yeah, and it's just his head. Alan Sherman, My Son, the Nut. I'm telling you, one of the greatest album covers of all time. And Heather would break every single night Matt did it. He would pull it off the shelf specifically and shove it right in her face. So when one of my favorite lines in it, and the way that Matt delivered it was fantastic. So Matt's basically making fun of this couple because they're going to buy a Hall & Oates CD, and he makes fun of them for that. He talks to the guy, and he's like, okay, what's your favorite? What are some of your favorite albums? Ozzy Osbourne. Oh, with or without Black Sabbath? Solo or with Black Sabbath? And he goes solo. Or no, so he goes Black Sabbath or solo? Or no, with Black Sabbath. He says, yeah. Do you like him solo? Yeah. With Randy Rhoads? Who? The guy goes, yeah. Who? And Barry goes, I'm done talking to you.
Is it weird that I think the film version? High fidelity.
Yeah.
Vinyl Shop is a version of High Fidelity.
Yeah.
Is it weird that I think that scene kind of made it into the movie just as two different bits? Because I remember when you gave me the DVD of the play.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, this seems like they kind of retooled this into being the bit with I Just Called to Say I Love You.
Yeah.
And also when Barry is giving that one dude all the records, it's like, you've never heard Blonde on Blonde? We're going to be okay, man.
Yeah.
I feel like they retooled the idea.
Well, the idea, I mean, it's, I'm not, you know, I don't know what to say, you know, but it was similar. We were beforehand. They came to see it. So I don't know.
I don't know what to say. I'm just saying it seems a little bit similar.
Yeah.
John Cusack, if you're out there.
Yeah. So. All right, Big Brother has begun. Now, Tom, you're going to go back and you're going to watch the rest of the episode this morning.
Yeah, I got to catch the first half.
Okay,
first half.
But you saw the second half.
I did.
It debuted last night, season 21 of Big Brother. I finally have a comrade in arms on this show because I've spent several years not being able to talk about Big Brother with anybody who works with me on the radio because nobody who I've ever worked with on the radio watched Big Brother and thought I was an idiot for watching it. So finally I have someone I can actually talk to about it. So it debuted last night. It's the Big Brother Summer Camp is what they're calling it. Camp Big Brother. And as I mentioned earlier, and by the way, if you watched it and you want to jump in, if you're a Big Brother fan, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. As I've said before, the internet buzz is really low about the house. The super fans of Big Brother cannot stand what the house looks like. They do not enjoy the facilities. They do not enjoy the Big Brother summer camp motif. That's sort of like the big takeaway from last night's episode on the internet, is that the fans do not like the house or the camp Big Brother theme. So all 18 house guests were introduced last night. They all met, and they all already, there are twists, and I'm not going to give anything away. I won't give anything away about what happened last night, but there are already, you know, there was already conniving, there was already planning, there was already vying for, you know, trying to get campaigning for votes for a certain thing that I won't give away. And then there's a big, you know, there's a big decision that has to be made tonight. But you did get to meet the contestants, the house guests. And so I'm going to go through some of them. The first one is named, her name is Holly Allen. She's 31. Her hometown is in Lander, Wyoming. She's from Los Angeles. And she is a wine sommelier and a safari guide. Which I found to be hilarious. And everybody seemed really impressed at what she does as a wine sommelier and a safari guide, which of course sounds like a weird combination. She made not a big impression on me. I don't think I'm going to enjoy her that much on the show. Next is Tommy Bracco, who's 28 years old, from Staten Island, lives in Staten Island. He's a Broadway dancer. I like this guy.
Is there more of a Staten Island name than Tommy Bracco?
Exactly. Exactly.
He looks like he's been on the set of Last Temptation.
He is. Yeah. Oh, he is a Broadway dancer, and he's flamboyantly gay, and he's totally a Broadway dancer, and he's got energy. He's already blown out gaskets with his volume. He's, you know, it's only been one episode, and he's his energy is already like people are going to either hate him or love him, and I actually right now I really like him. Let's see. Next is, this is a slide by slide thing. Of course, they put it. Annalise Talavera, who is in Simi Valley, California. She is a college soccer star. She's only 22.
Yeah, she didn't strike me as anything super exciting.
No.
She's taught, in her little aside, she was in the confession thing. She was talking a lot about, my game, you know, I want to throw off my game. I'm like, all right, you're laying it on a little bit thick.
I agree. Then there's Ovi Kabir, who's 22, from Knoxville, Tennessee, or from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, but he lives in Knoxville. He's a college student. I like this guy a lot.
Seems like fun.
Yeah,
seems
like I really like him a lot. Here's how they describe three adjectives that describe you: relatable, motivated, and brown. I like him. Okay, here's our Chicagoan. So we got to at least root for her, right? For a while, Jessica Milagros, who doesn't give her age, says she's 30-ish. She lives in Oak Park, but she's from Chicago, and she's a plus size model. And I like her so far. And she was part of a plot thing that happened last night that I won't give away. But she's from Chicago, so I always root for anybody who's from Chicago.
Yeah, you gotta.
Yeah, I always do. I do it on Top Chef. I do it on all the reality shows.
Until they give you a reason to hate him.
If they'd give me a reason to hate him. So far, she hasn't. All right, here's Jack Matthews. His hometown is Chicago, so I guess I have to root for him. He lives in Tampa. He's a fitness trainer, and he looks exactly like Jason Momoa.
It's shocking.
Yeah,
he's even got the same like kind of blonde highlights in his hair.
Exactly. He's got the beard. He's got the whole thing. He's only 28 years old, and if you've watched the episode, he's from Chicago, but he lives in Tampa, and he looks exactly like Jason Momoa. And I like him.
He's got a fun personality.
Yeah,
from what I can tell,
I actually like him more than Jason Momoa. So, all right, we got more of the new cast members to talk about here. If you watched Big Brother, if you're a fan. And last night you watched it, you want to give us a call or a text, we'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. Wow. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Who picked the Henry Mancini?
Pink Panther theme coming to us from Lake Geneva Dan.
Lake Geneva Dan. All right.
I wonder where he is.
I think he might be in Cleveland.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. Wildcard Wednesday continuing. Yeah, Wildcard Wednesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And Big Brother debuted last night, and that's what we're talking about. Big Brother 21. I am a big fan of Big Brother, and I'm now not alone in this show of being a fan of Big Brother. My producer Tom happens to be a fan. This is the first time I would ever be able to discuss it with someone who I work with, because anytime I would ever bring it up, everybody else I've worked with on the show over the years would be like, "Why don't you just shut up?" And then they'd punch me in the mouth and kick me in the teeth just because I watch Big Brother. So we're going through the cast members, the house guests who were introduced on the show last night. And the part two of the season premiere, the big season premiere, is tonight at 7 o'clock, and it's all on CBS. So we've been going through the house guests. Got a couple of texts here. 847 area code says, "Hi, Nick. I love you and your show. I've been watching Big Brother since it started, and I love it." Oh, good. "Very interesting cast, and as always, some goofball or strange one in the crowd. I'm going to be interested to see who's going to get picked to go from here." Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know who casts these shows, but they always get like the types. And the other thing about watching Big Brother is that there's a period of time once they kind of settle in, maybe 2, 3, 4 episodes in. And by the way, if you don't know what Big Brother is, it's a group of strangers who live in a house for 3 months, cut away from all social media and news and everything. They're just in this house for 3 months. They have to do a bunch of challenges. Someone gets eliminated every week. Someone gets evicted every week. There are alliances that are formed, and there are strategies that have to be done. The last person standing wins $500,000 who doesn't get evicted from the Big Brother house. That's what it is. Cameras are on them 24/7, for real, 24/7. You can watch the 24-hour live feed of the cameras that are placed throughout the entire house and microphones that are throughout the entire house 24/7 on CBS All Access. And you can also watch Big Brother After Dark on Pop, your Pop channel, which I sometimes find myself doing. You know when I do that, Tom, when I watch Big Brother After Dark? Whenever there is a challenge for HOH that doesn't end at the end of the episode, you don't know who becomes HOH. Like it's an endurance challenge. Every time I will go back, I'll tape it, and then in the morning I'll watch it just so I see who's got the key. So I figure out who wins the HOH.
Yeah.
that's how dorky I am.
Dedication.
Yeah.
You know,
no, but there are people, I know people who watch the feed all the time.
I'm not kidding. I might just start having that open during the show. Just have my laptop sit on top of something.
And then just have it going.
Occasionally I'll be like, "Nick,
you're not going to believe what happened.
She sneezed."
262 area code says, "Hey, Nick, my daughter's a fan of Big Brother. I was wondering if you were going to have a Big Brother update other than on the radio." Well, I mean, we'll do Big Brother talks now, for sure, now that Tom's going to be watching.
Mm-hmm.
I will not give anything away. I refuse to like give out spoilers or anything.
Sure.
I'm not going to say who, you know, like on certain nights who wins at a household and so on and so forth. I won't do that. 847 area code says, "Hey guys, been working a lot and I haven't been able to text this in, but I just wanted to give a shout out to your producer Tom. His English accent on Friday had me dying. It was awesome. I haven't laughed that hard in a while. What was his character's name? It's Slap Slaply."
Yeah.
Slap Slaply.
But he's in Kent right now. He's back home from
Kent.
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to these house guests on Big Brother. Nicole Anthony, she's from Long Island, New York. She's a preschool age. She's 24, and she's very odd. Very odd. At one point, her mother came out during her introduction montage, and she was drawing a beautiful unicorn. She's the weird, awkward one, and I like her. I always kind of like the weird, awkward ones.
She looks like the main character from She's All That.
But she's got the glasses and the... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next is David Alexander. He's 29. He's from Atlanta. He's a photographer. He's one of these guys who lost a bunch of weight and is now a CrossFit guy. He seemed okay to me. He didn't make a massive impression on me. Okay, who is your next one? Christy Murphy. She's from Staten Island, New York, but she lives in Keyport, New Jersey, and she owns a clothing boutique. She's 28 years old. I like her. Now, and I won't give away a twist. I will not give away a twist, but a twist happens between her and Bobby, the Broadway dancer.
Ooh.
I won't tell you what it is, but something's happening. Something happens when they first see each other in the house. Something happens, and I won't give it away. Here's one of the reasons why I like her. I think she looks like Elizabeth Moss.
She does.
Yeah. So that's going to make me happy. I'll be looking at someone who looks like Elizabeth Moss for the entire summer.
That'd be so fun.
Yeah. All right. We got a break here. All right. Let's take a break. Come back, finish discussing this, and then talk about some of the past winners from Big Brother. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN Wildcard Wednesday. You hear me, Wildcard Wednesday? If I'm not mistaken, that was actually composed by John Williams.
Really?
Yeah, that was an early John Williams. That's the Lost in Space.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah. There were two different Lost in Space themes.
That is true.
They changed the theme song, but I'm pretty sure John Williams did that. Who requested Lost in Space?
That's coming to us from Mr. B. Mr. B.
I thought you could say Mr. Bean. Say Rowan Atkinson is listening to the show. Welcome back, everybody. Hey, you know what? It's time for Know Your Onion. So we need a couple of people to call in right now, and you will be our only two contestants. So we take a contestant one at a time. The phone lines are open right now. First person through at 312-981-7200. First two people through will be our two contestants for the morning for the two rounds of Know Your Onion. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. The deal is this. We'll get our contestants on. They will play separately. Tom is your host. He will read you some news headlines, and you have to guess whether they are real or whether they are from The Onion, the fake news comedy satirical newspaper. So he'll read you a headline, and you have to just say real or onion. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and everybody's going to be a winner if you get a majority of the news headlines correctly, whether they are real or whether they are the onion, you will win. That's how the game works, and we're getting our second contestant all set up here. So 312-981-7200. We do this every Wednesday morning at 4:30. Tom came up with this idea, and the news is so weird now. The real news is so weird that sometimes even real headlines sound like they came out of The Onion. It's just a very weird time to be alive. So we have our two contestants. They're on the line, and they're ready to go. We'll do them one at a time. And let's do an opening, shall we?
It's time to Know Your Onion.
That's right. Ah, yes. Another big crowd.
Huge.
There's at least 36,000 people here. Right in the studio.
Here on the beautiful Allstate Skyline.
That's right.
Studio.
18 stories up. They took the elevator all the way up. All right, so we get the idea. Let's bring in our first contestant. It's Carrie on WGN. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, morning, Nick.
Good morning. Okay, you understand the game, right?
I do.
All right, Tom,
I love the segment.
Thanks, man. Tom is going to read you a news headline, and you have to decide whether it's real or it's The Onion. So, are you ready?
I am.
Okay, here we go.
All right, Carrie, we're going to start off down south with this one. An Alabama car dealership offers customers a gun, a Bible, and a flag to celebrate the 4th of July. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Oh, jeez, man. In this... Oh, man. You know what? I do remember in the past there were car dealers giving away guns, but I'm gonna oddly say it's real.
Very good, Carrie. That is real.
That's insane.
Coming to us from NBC 15 in Mobile, Alabama.
That's insane. A Bible, a gun, a flag.
Oh, man. I was just in Mobile for work, and thank God I didn't know about that. I would have ran.
All right. Well, good job. You're one for one, Carrie.
Okay.
All right.
All right, next up, Carrie. The Disney estate uncovers a cache of anti-American cartoons intended for release if the Axis won World War II. Is that real or is that The Onion?
I'm going to, well, they made a lot of weird cartoons during the war, but I'm going to say that's The Onion.
Very good.
It's The Onion. Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what they were the idea of that Onion article is that they were just hedging their bets.
Yeah.
They're like, we still want to be very, very popular.
Well, we all know Disney.
Yeah.
We all know Walt.
Yeah.
So he
yeah.
had his own thoughts.
Yeah. All right, man.
Things.
You are 2 for 2. You get one more. You're a winner because we the idea is to read 5. And if you get 3, that's a majority.
Okay.
All right. All right, Carrie. Here's the next one. This is coming to us from the Olympics. Breakdancing is among 4 sports provisionally added to the 2024 Olympic program. Is that real or is that The Onion?
I'm hoping it's The Onion.
Let's see.
Oh, geez. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I actually heard this. I actually heard this. And also, you know what else is being added? Lightsaber fighting.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
So my many years of watching Star Wars and Breakin' 2 are going to pay off someday.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. No, lightsaber fighting, you know, it's now going to be like an Olympic sport.
That's
I think I'd rather watch anti-American Walt Disney cartoons than that.
Okay. Okay. You got 2 more chances here.
Okay.
All right. Let's try some sports here with the NBA. NBA commentators confirm that Steve Kerr is not enough of an insufferable jerk to be considered an all-time great coach. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Oh, jeez. He is a nice guy. I'll say Onion.
Let's see.
Sha-win.
Very good, Gary. Right.
Very nice. Very nice.
There it is. This is
Steve Kerr. Talking about Steve Kerr, man. All right. Well, hey, Kerry, nice job, man.
All right, thanks.
You have won. You got 3 out of 5. That's what you needed, and you're going to get yourself the big prize here is a $25 gift card to Anderson's Candy Shop with locations in Richmond or Barrington or online at andersonscandyshop.com. And you're invited this weekend to Anderson's 100th anniversary party on June 29th, June 30th in downtown Richmond and at Anderson's Candy Shop on Main Street.
Awesome. There's so a dog and suds right. There's a dog and suds right in Richmond. So I'll have to go.
You stop in there. Stop in there on your way back or on your way there.
We'll do.
All right,
we'll
Kerry. Congratulations,
thanks,
buddy.
Guys.
Okay, man. There you go. Kerry's our winner. That's how it works. Is it real or is it The Onion?
Don't forget to stay on the line, Kerry.
Kerry, stay on the
line.
I'll
get your info soon.
Stay on the line. He'll get you. He'll get you very soon. All right. We got to do a round two now of Know Your Onion as we do every. Thursday or Wednesday morning. I don't even know what the hell day it is now. Wednesday morning. It's the heat, man. It's driving me nuts. And hasn't even gotten all that hot yet. Just wait till Saturday. All my brains are going to be melted.
Oof.
All right, here's Russ on WGN. Hi, Russ.
Good morning.
Good morning. You familiar with The Onion? You know the you get the gist of this?
Oh, yeah. I listen to it all the time.
All right. Well, we are Knowing Your Onion. So all you got to do is you hear the news headline, and you just say, real or onion? You get 3 out of 5, or you win.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All right, Russ, here's your first headline. Researchers teach gray seals to sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Is that real, or is that The Onion?
The Onion.
Let's see.
Oh,
no.
That's real?
Yes. Researchers at St. Andrews University in Scotland have managed to teach gray seals how to sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and the Star Wars theme.
You know that's your homeland.
I know. This is what all those tax dollars are going towards.
All right. You're 0 for 1, Russ, but that was a hard one. I would have never thought that that was real. I would have went with The Onion as well.
Yeah, that was rough.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. That's okay, man. Here we go.
Plenty of chances. Next up, the Aretha Franklin Institute for Female Entrepreneurship confirms that sisters are doing it for themselves. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Real.
Let's see.
No, that's The Onion. That one had an onion feel to it. Yeah.
It did. Yeah.
So, all right. You got to get the next 3, Russ.
Okay, I think we might.
Yeah, you're under the gun here, my man. You're under the gun that I just got from Alabama. So you, so
table.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Next up, this is in politics. Chuck Schumer says the American people deserve a president who can more credibly justify a war with Iran. Is that real or is that The Onion?
The Onion.
Very good. Yeah. There you go. Staying alive.
Because you have to credibly justify a war with Iran.
Yep. Okay. Let's see. You got a few more left here, Russ.
Two to go, right? No.
We got three to go.
Okay.
Yeah, he's got to get the next three in a row.
You got to get the next two. He got this one, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
So he's got to get two in a row. Or not two in a row, but you got to get two out of three here.
Okay. So next up, a woman, 93 years old, was arrested as her dying wish after being good all of her life. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Sounds like The Onion.
Let's see. Oh. That's a very real headline.
I think that's a good. I like that story.
Yeah, a woman at 93 years old wanted to be arrested.
She wanted to have the experience of being arrested.
Yeah,
I like that story. Where was that out of?
That was in The Guardian.
I like that. Okay, all right. Now let's see. Now Russ, you got to get the next two. You're under the gun again from Alabama.
Okay.
You got to get the next two. Okay.
All right. Here we go. Thousands petition Netflix to cancel Amazon Prime's Good Omens. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Real.
Let's see. Very nice, Ross.
So people are so stupid. People are so stupid. they're petitioning Netflix to get rid of a show that's on Amazon Prime. That's so ridiculous. Oh, man. All right. Okay. Now you're down to your last one. We're making it. This is suspenseful. This is as suspenseful as it gets. So, Russ, you got to get this one right.
Down to my last bullet for my gun.
That's right.
Okay. Here's the headline. Zach Braff and Alyssa Milano call out Trump for far more effectively pivoting to politics to save floundering career. Is that real or is that The Onion?
The Onion.
Nice job.
Nice. There you go.
Nice way to come back, Russ. Nice job making it very exciting. Very, very exciting. Yeah.
It was rough.
Yeah. Well, you did a good job, man. You got yourself a $25 gift card to Anderson's Candy Shop. It's locations in Richmond and Barrington, or online at andersonscandyshop.com. And this weekend, it's going to be a blast. You're invited to the Anderson's 100th anniversary party. And June 29th and 30th in downtown Richmond and the Anderson's Candy Shop on Main Street. So have fun. Enjoy your Anderson's Candy Shop gift card. Congratulations, and thanks for listening and playing. All right, Russ?
All right, thank you.
You got to hold on, okay?
Okay.
Hey, hang on. There we go. All right. Two winners, two successful people navigating the world of news headlines on Know Your Onion. We'll do Know Your Onion again next week. At the same time at 4:30. So, all right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. We're going to wrap up our recap of last night's Big Brother premiere 21. And then on tomorrow's show, since we're, it's on again tonight. But on tomorrow morning's show, we'll do another quick recap and then talk about some of the best winners of Big Brother history. But when we come back, if you want to jump in, we're going to wrap up the show and wrap up all of our conversation about Big Brother last night's episode and the house guests at 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're wrapping up Wild Card Wednesday. You mean Wild Card Wednesday? Yeah. So who requested the 9-inch nails?
That was Ike.
Ike.
Yeah, 1989's Pretty Hate Machine.
Yeah.
He wanted me to include with that, have you seen any of the new Black Mirror, the one with Miley Cyrus?
I have not.
All right.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
Me neither. I stopped watching Hannah Montana years ago.
Oh, hold on a minute. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Coming up, Steve Gazanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So there you go. We've been talking about Big Brother. It debuted, season 21 debuted last night, and I was wondering what you guys thought of it. And we've been going through the new house guests. 312-981-7200 if you want to join us. Next is Sam Smith. He's 31. He's a truck driver from Mountaintop, Pennsylvania. He's married. He's got twins, and he's going to miss his family, and he's got a terrible tribal tattoo.
Yeah, he annoys me already.
Yeah, he annoys me, too.
He rubs me the wrong way, something about him.
Yeah. But his tattoo is just, it's a bad tattoo. It's a bad tattoo. And he talked about how great his tattoo is, though, during his intro.
That's how you know it's a bad tattoo.
Yeah. Here's the next one. Catherine Dunn, 29. Hometown is Irving, Texas. She's in Dallas. She's from Dallas. She's a digital marketing executive. Hey, you know what? I got to tell you, I'm looking at her right now. I don't even remember.
She's a little forgettable.
Clearly. Yeah. I don't even remember. She's from Dallas. I'm trying to think of what her package was when they introduced her. She had a photographer taking pictures of her while she was like strolling through the park. Yeah, because she was like, I'm really bad at selfies. So she had a photographer follow her around the park during her video package. Yeah, no.
Yeah, self-deprecation doesn't work when you're like gorgeous.
Yeah. So, the impression, she didn't make much of an impression on me, but not, yeah. All right, how about Cliff Hogg III?
Yeah.
This is your boy right here?
Right here. I'm going all in on Cliff Hogg.
He's a petroleum engineer. He's had guns pulled on him. He's been in all kinds of crazy situations. He's from Houston. He wears a cowboy hat. And he's the old man, as he said a bunch of times on last night's episode. He goes, I'm the old man, and I know the old guys. The old guys get a target on their back pretty soon. He said that during his introduction when they're all sitting in the living room, drinking champagne and introducing one another. He's like, I'm the old guy. Yeah, yeah. You know how old he is?
Tell me.
He's 53. You know how old I am? I'm 53.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm an old man. I'm an old man, and the old man has a target on his back. He's 53 years old.
Oh, you're like the crypt keeper.
But I will tell you this. He looks older than 53.
He does. You were blessed with like the baby face sort of deal.
Well, yeah,
I look way younger than you actually. I know.
I know that. It's weird because my family has that thing. I do not look like I'm 50. I'm going to be 54 in like a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm older than the old man. And I love the fact that he's Cliff Hogg III.
There's three generations of Hogg.
Three generations of Cliff Hogg. But he's right though. The older house guests are usually one of the first to go.
Yeah,
I mean, and because a lot of this stuff is very physical, you know. And he doesn't look like he's in shape.
Well, you know, maybe he's got some of those farm muscles.
He might,
because you know sometimes you got these guys that are kind of big looking, but they've been working on the farm their whole life, and all the it's packed underneath.
Yeah, well, like there's a lot of room for him to pack stuff. That's all I'm saying. Kemi Fecknuel is 25. She's from Maryland, but her current city is Brooklyn, New York, and she's a marketing strategist. I'll tell you this. She's going to be the antagonistic one, sort of the quote-unquote bitchy one. But so far, I like her. And that's the path she's taking. And I'm sure that she will be reviled by a lot of people who watch the show. But for some reason, I don't know. Her confessionals were really funny. In the confessional, her stuff in the confessional was very, very funny. But you know she's going to be confrontational, and she talks about how people don't get her sense of humor, and she's not even remotely funny.
Yeah, I got to pull out from her bio here on CBS.com. This is an actual line. It took me 24 years to actually learn the difference between feeling provoked and actually being provoked. Growth.
No. That's that what she really
yeah,
said?
Yeah, no, that's that does not bode well for her. Oh, man.
All right. Here is Nick McCrone, 27 years old. Hometown and current city is Sewell, New Jersey. And he is a therapist. But you couldn't see that by his package. Now that's going to show up on the Friday show. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I realized straight out of context. But he's like in his video package that they did the profile of him. He's like mouthing off to guys on the basketball court, and like slamming basketballs off of guys' heads, and then dunking on them and stuff, and then being a real jerk. And he's a child therapist. Then they cut to him talking to a child going, I'm glad you're feeling better because last week you were breaking lamps and throwing chairs. I'm not kidding.
Well, he's got to get the energy out somewhere. You know, maybe he's dealing with a particularly difficult child. That's can be a high stress job.
I didn't know what to make of this guy, quite frankly.
I'm glad he's not bouncing basketballs off the kids' heads.
Yeah. No, he didn't. He was like, that. Maybe that's part of his therapy, is to bounce basketballs off kids' heads. Here's Isabella Wang. She's 22. Hometown is Mount Olive, New Jersey, but she lives in Los Angeles. She is a public health analyst. Her video package was very entertaining. And I think I like her because she grew up in a very strict household, and her mom doesn't understand what TV is. Wants her to be straight-laced, but meanwhile, she's secretly getting tattoos and stuff.
Oh, nice.
And not doing, you know, so she said there's two of her. There's the Izza side, and the Izza side is, listens to her mother, who's, I believe, first generation.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said there's the Bella side, and then they cut to her doing shots and screaming. So she's got two sides to her. She's 22 years old. She's a kid.
Hey, what side do you think she is today? And there she is just downing a bottle of
Malort. Well, she's going to be in the house for 3 months.
Man.
I think we're going to see a lot more Bella than Izza. That's my prediction.
Yeah.
All right, now here's the first guy I don't like at all. Jackson Michie,
mm-hmm.
24 years old, hometown Nashville, Tennessee, lives in Los Angeles. They never said on the air what he did for a living. He's a server. They didn't say that. But this is like the southern guy. The sort of like, he's the guy, I like to shoot guns, and he and Jack, the Aquaman look alike. They immediately are going to start a bromance because they're like, we're going to have to work out together, man.
Yeah. This guy has the squarest head I've ever seen. It's scary. His, you know how a jaw normally kind of like.
Yeah.
Has a little bit of a point or a round. Yeah. This guy, it's literally just cuts off.
Yeah.
To square.
He looks like a Muppet. this guy made a bad impression on me pretty mm-hmm. much right from the get-go all the way through the episode.
So based on the end of last night's episode, there'll be some plays from him.
It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
So those are the players. I think... Uvi is probably my favorite at this point, and Bobby, the Broadway dancer. I think those are my two favorites.
Just wait till you join Team Hog. Come on, man.
He's an old man. He's 53.
He's an old man.
Old man, 53. All right, we're going to break. Hey, on tomorrow's show, an old friend of mine, Tara Handren, is going to join us. She's a terrific actress and a performer and a writer. I directed her a long time in a play, and she's got a one-woman show about alcoholism and recovery.